5, 4, 3.
She's pure alligator. Pure white.
2.
Albinos that do make it to reproductive age can't find a mate because they look funny.
1.
Albino affairs.
Rare visitors at the Saco River Wildlife Center.
Yeah, they took in not one, but two albino porcupines recently. The center says one in every 10,000 porcupines is an albino. Unfortunately, they're both in pretty bad shape and they do need some care.
The center says one appears to have been hit by a car or maybe it fell, and another had crusty eyes and nose. They're now getting care all around the clock.
Porcupines in general, the biggest reason that we see them in rehab is either the common ones hit by car or orphaned, but also we get a lot of them in because they're very susceptible to mange, ringworm, and there's an upper respiratory infection that they're susceptible to.
The Saco River Wildlife Center is asking for donations to help care for the porcupines. If you'd like to help, we have information on our website, WGME.com.
But they will make it look like some black person is in charge. They ain't in charge of nothing. Colin Powell sat there and read a script that was bogus. And I think it bothers him to this day. They got him to tell a bunch of lies that started that Iraq mess. It turned out to be lies. I'm not calling it lies. I mean, that's what everybody says it was. Weapons of mass destruction. There wasn't any. But they had Colin Powell read it. And I said that that's what they were doing at the time, what I suspected that they were doing. I didn't have no way of proving it. I just know how the white supremacists operate. I said, they could have read that themselves. They didn't need Colin Powell, except they wanted to put a black face on it.
I'm grieving as though I've lost someone in my family. I was watching CBS Mornings last week when Gail King interrupted the show's planned program with the breaking news that former Secretary of State Colin Powell, the first African-American to serve in that role, had died. I never met him personally, but I regarded him with the respect accorded to elders in the family. And he was a lauded member of the larger family of African-American firsts, those path-breaking pioneers who overcame long-standing, sometimes near impossible obstacles. They achieved at the highest levels to enter circles previously closed to people of color. I didn't know who he was until President George H.W. Bush nominated him to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the first African American. I didn't know that he'd already broken through decades of closed doors when he served as assistant to the Deputy Secretary of Defense under President Carter, before President Ronald Reagan named him his national security advisor, again, the first African American. I didn't know that at 52 years old, he was one of the youngest four-star generals, and that in nominating him, President Bush selected him from a group of more than 30 other possible candidates. A fact, according to reporting by the New York Times, that didn't sit well with more than a few who felt they had been passed over for the prestigious assignment. In his Rose Garden announcement, President Bush praised General Powell and emphasized, "It is most important that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs be a person of breadth, judgment, experience, and total integrity," words many others would use to describe him throughout his career and after his passing. With the Joint Chiefs of Staff nomination, General Powell was propelled into a huge public spotlight, and soon, like so many others, I was learning about his life story and career. Black people across the nation were proud, even some critical of his Republican Party affiliation. General Powell made a few brief remarks in the Rose Garden, pointing out the stark opportunities and challenges in leading the Joint Chiefs, and saying how he was especially privileged and somewhat humbled to follow his predecessor into the role. But in the days following the official nomination, reporters had been unsuccessful in pinning him down for a substantive interview. So it was a particular thrill for me and my fellow members of the National Association of Black Journalists when he agreed to speak first at our annual conference. His appearance was now a newsmaker's event, drawing legions of our fellow reporters. Though the pomp and circumstance was impressive, I was struck by his determination to use the platform to credit the Black folks who paved the way for him. On that day at the national conference, he was emotional as he talked about standing on the shoulders of the Buffalo Soldiers, the 6 all-Black units of men who protected the Western territories after the Civil War, and the Tuskegee Airmen, the African-American military pilots and airmen who fought in World War II. In a commencement speech years later, he was even more emphatic, saying, "I will never forget my debt to them. I just didn't show up. I climbed on the backs of those who never had the opportunity that I had." His words had a particular resonance for me and so many others in the room. We, too, were first in our newsrooms. I am well aware that Secretary of State Colin Powell's career was not without blemish, none bigger than his part in the weapons of mass destruction argument which led to the Iraq War. And I have never shared his moderate, don't rock the boat Republican politics. But I have nothing but admiration for how he used his first platform to make sure he was not the first and only, through quiet connections out of the public eye, and through the youth-focused initiative, part of his America's Promise Alliance. Rest in peace, Secretary Powell. Yours was a life well-lived and well-served. Callie Crossley, GBH, Boston's local NPR.
Are too many fluffernutters giving you a dad bod?
No. What have you heard? Do your Votorama sessions always descend into whataboutism?
If those questions do not make sense, don't worry. You can look up those words in the Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary. They added 455 new words and definitions this month.
Peter Sokolowski is Merriam-Webster's editor-at-large.
The sort of fun part of the job is noticing new vocabulary and then watching it grow. We don't want to add a term that might fall away from usage. We need a lot of evidence.
Some words, though, made an immediate impact, like those we've come to know during the pandemic.
In this case, we have new senses of existing terms, like breakthrough, as in breakthrough infection.
Getting a breakthrough infection.
You'll get a breakthrough infection.
And super spreader.
That turned into a super spreader event.
Which we had defined referring to an individual who spread disease among a population, but now it refers, of course, to events or locations that are responsible for the spread of the disease.
Some of the words have been around for decades, like fluffernutter, come on.
That refers to a peanut butter and marshmallow fluff sandwich.
First you spread your bread with peanut butter and marshmallow fluff, and have a fluffernutter.
This is a term that is somewhat regional, and maybe that's why it's new to many people. It's not new to me because I grew up in New England.
And that's where the dad bod comes in. Now, more food enters the Merriam-Webster lexicon, this time borrowed from Spanish, and I can't believe it's taken this long to include the creamy drink horchata and the crispy pork snack chicharrón.
English has a voracious appetite for words from other languages, and the language has this elastic capacity to grow.
Just a few more as evidence of that growth. Deplatform, oobleck, faux hawk, bit rot. If you don't know what they mean, now you can look them up.
In a little over a month, the country of Barbados is set to become a republic, some 55 years after it gained independence from the United Kingdom. For the last few months, Barbados has shed symbols of its colonial past, taking down statues and removing Queen Elizabeth II from the role of head of state. Last week, Barbados Parliament elected a president, Dame Sandra Mason, which means that two women, the prime minister and president, will lead the country when Mason is sworn in next month. Here she is speaking last year to the people of Barbados.
The time has come to fully leave our colonial past behind. Barbadians want a Barbadian head of state.
To talk more about what this moment means is Mackie Holder, Consul General of Barbados at New York. He joins us now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
We're actually speaking to you from Barbados. What has the atmosphere been like since this announcement about Dame Sandra Mason becoming president?
There's a level of excitement, but Barbadians are traditionally very quiet persons. We don't really shout a lot. But I think it's a good thing for Barbados. It's part of our journey to maturity as a nation, especially for a younger generation of Barbadians. It sets a new benchmark, which says that Barbados is indeed an island nation, fully able to govern its own affairs, as it has clearly demonstrated over decades.
Help us understand the role that the UK had in the day-to-day affairs of the country.
What it has given us is a certain amount of order and stability, and now we're at this stage in our progress.
I want to talk about some of the symbolism in terms of breaking away from a colonial past, because earlier this year, the statue of Lord Horatio Nelson was brought down. And here in the U.S., Confederate statues are being removed in parts of the country as well. Do you think that the movement that's driving that here in the U.S., the Black Lives Matter protest, has actually had anything to do with some of the momentum in Barbados?
I'm not so sure that it has. The whole debate on removing Nelson's statue has been going on for some time. And again, some things just coalesce, and I just think it was time.
Do you think that once Barbados is a republic, the country will be positioned to maybe have a bigger role in regional or even global politics?
I don't think it's going to position us less or more. At the end of the day, Barbados is driven by its people and its leaders. We will continue to play important roles on the world stage and in the region. I think people just think that if you become a republic, that there's going to be some seismic change and some magical thing. The truth is, though, that Barbados has been a solid country, a very successful country for centuries, and it will continue to be so.
Maybe in a way, that's why I'm asking. The country has been successful. Things have been going fine. Why do you think this move is significant at the end of the day?
Because I think all countries need to have symbolism. These things are important for your psyche, for what it says about you as a nation. You know, that is why countries have heroes. That is why countries are so integrated into their sports. It is important that you make these kind of symbolic moves so that for younger generations, they see a nation that reflects themselves. Why should a Barbadian not grow up to know that they have been Barbados heroes?
I was born in Jamaica, and I know Jamaica is considering a similar move. St. Lucia, St. Vincent have also flirted with the idea. Do you see a path forward for other countries to follow suit?
Other Caribbean countries certainly will follow. Whether that will happen in 6 months, in a year, who knows? But I expect as we go further into the 21st century that we'll see some changes among other countries in the Caribbean as well.
That is Mackie Holder, Consul General of Barbados. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Did you say you saw someone steal a police horse this week?
I'll send you the video, Gus. I sent it to the firefighter. All-time classic, all-time. It might have stopped when they pulled Reginald Barry out the car, Reginald Denny out the car. I mean, this was I'm going to send it to you. His brothers had his black cow with this, and they're like, where'd you get the police?
They stole him. Come on. I'm wounded.
I stole from the police.
I'm wounded. I'm wounded. I'm totally wounded. That's
Chicago.
Gus, I just want to report that stealing the horse was a false report. The guy who was videotaped, he actually owned that horse. And he was falsely accused of stealing a police horse and basically got his car spray painted saying, return the horse. Yeah. So that was a false report.
Can't do it.
We're going to focus now on another allegation against Facebook that the company didn't do enough to prevent extremists from organizing online and ultimately attacking the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. According to the documents, Facebook did put measures in place to deal with potential violence around the 2020 election. But when a movement built on a lie got traction, it was called Stop the Steal, those measures fell short. Yael Eisenstadt was the global head of elections integrity operations at Facebook in 2018. I asked her how this misinformation was allowed to spread.
This is something that was years in the making, and maybe not Stop the Steal in particular, but just the fact that for years, people, whether it was people like myself, people who work in the company, researchers, journalists, outside academics, had been warning the company that the way their project is working, which is there's multiple things here, the way they amplify certain kind of content, the way they recommend people into certain groups, was causing a situation that was already amplifying some of the most extreme voices. But then you couple that with what I believe was one of their most dangerous political decisions the company made, and this was actually around the time that I was working there, to not fact-check political actors, to allow some of the biggest voices with the biggest platforms to violate their own policies. These combined to make this perfect storm. So when they talk about all the measures that they put in place to protect the elections, that doesn't override all the things that they were not doing, such as really making sure that groups weren't engaging in this kind of activity, making sure that certain political elites were not using the platform to spread lies about the election. This was going on for years. It's not something they could have stopped suddenly in 3 days after an election.
So it seems like there's two issues as you just laid them out. It's vetting the potential of any particular actor to spread lies and misinformation, but also once it's out there, taking it down, right?
So even more, I mean, content moderation, what to take down and what to leave up is extremely difficult. And yes, that is something that is on the platforms to handle because that is definitely not government's area. But how your platform is designed, how you're monetizing it, what you're allowing and what you're not, basic guardrails, that's what's really missing here. Mm. I mean, as you said, once if you for years have allowed an environment where you're not holding politicians to the same standards that you're holding the rest of us to on your platform because really you want to preserve your power and you're not sort of reining in these algorithms and recommendation engines that are pushing people to a lot of this content, which some of the documents, I mean, this piece about Carol's journey to QAnon is the perfect example. And that's really about not wanting to harm your own growth. So you're not reining in how your recommendation engines are pushing people into some of these groups. Those two things combine around a time where we have a really volatile situation in the U.S. around our election. It's a perfect storm. And let's be clear, Facebook had years to fix this. A lot of the documents are focusing on 2019 and 2020. But this is work that many people have been trying to get them to do, including my team when I was there, for years.
What were you met with when you raised these red flags, when you raised these concerns?
Sure. So in 2018, the very first thing I tried to do was ask why we were not putting any sort of fact-checking standards into political advertising. And why I did that was it was very clear to me that advertising, first of all, maybe not the most important thing on the platform, but it's paid speech. We're putting labels on the ads to make them look even more credible. And we're giving the political actors targeting tools to target people with these messaging. And if we weren't even fact-checking that and we were allowing politicians to use advertising to sow different messages to different groups, that was dangerous. And there was no appetite. I was pushed out for these kinds of ideas and for the ideas to try to build in voter suppression plans into political advertising. There just wasn't an appetite from leadership for that.
You think that's likely to change now with all this pressure?
I think it can only change through regulation, to be honest. They have made it clear they will not self-regulate.
Yael Eisenstadt, she's Facebook's former global head of elections integrity operations for political advertising. We appreciate all of your perspective. Thank you.
Thank you.
This the city of Chicago.
Several top managers of the Chicago Blackhawks are no longer with the team today. That comes in response to an internal investigation over how the team handled a player's allegations of sexual assault by an assistant coach in 2010. The team CEO also now wants to try to settle two lawsuits related to its handling of the alleged assault. WBEZ's Tony Arnold has been investigating this for months now, and he broke the story earlier this year. He joins us now to talk about today's action. Tony, welcome.
Hi, Melba. Thanks for having me.
So first, Tony, walk us through this. When did you first learn about the allegations against the Blackhawks and how they handled the allegation against a coach?
Well, in May, we first learned that a former player sued the team. He was 20 years old at the time of the incident, and he remains anonymous and goes by John Doe in court documents. Now, John Doe alleges that an assistant coach, Brad Aldrich, sexually assaulted him during the 2010 playoffs before they would ultimately win the Stanley Cup. Now, Aldrich, after he left the team that year, went on to other hockey teams in college and even high school. And in 2013, he pleaded guilty to sexual conduct involving a student in Michigan who was a player on the team that he was helping coach. That student is also suing the Blackhawks. And the Blackhawks, for months, have denied that they mishandled the player's allegations, and they sought to dismiss the lawsuits.
And Tony, your past reporting, in fact, found 7 different allegations of unwanted sexual advances against Aldridge, even though he was only charged criminally in that one instance you mentioned. The Blackhawks hired a law firm to investigate the team's handling of the investigations. Tell us about what that report has found.
Well, the report made public today finds that the team took no action for 3 weeks after learning of the alleged assault, and that Aldridge essentially faced no consequences. We learned today that an intern claims that after the team won the Stanley Cup, Aldridge grabbed him against his will. That makes 8 people now that with claims against Aldridge that we know of. And Aldridge was allowed to resign from the team quietly. He got to celebrate with the Blackhawks in their 2010 Stanley Cup win in the presence of the player whom he allegedly assaulted. The other thing from the report that we see a lot more of detail about is who knew what and when back in 2010. The former player told more people about it than we had previously reported. And the report found that the Blackhawks, in the middle of this big Stanley Cup run, appeared to intentionally sit on the allegations to focus on the playoffs.
And what actions are the Blackhawks taking now?
Well, they're taking action with a hammer today. Danny Wirtz, the Blackhawks CEO, called the findings of the investigation disturbing and says he's encouraging the lawyers to essentially settle the lawsuits against the team. That's a complete reversal from the team's posture in court up until now.
It is clear that in 2010, the executives of this organization put team performance above all else. John Doe deserved better from the Blackhawks.
And Danny Wirtz also announced that Stan Bowman, the team's general manager, whose first year was in 2010, is out. And the team also cleaned house from other managers who knew about this in 2010 but didn't act.
And Tony, do we know if this will conclude the investigation for the Blackhawks?
You know, there's still some moving parts. The NHL's fined the Blackhawks $2 million. Coach Joel Quenneville, he's a revered figure in Chicago for the Stanley Cups that he brought here. He now coaches the Florida Panthers, and the NHL says it wants to talk to him about his role in all of this. It's unclear what his future in the league is going to be. And the same is true for the general manager of the Winnipeg Jets, who was also with the Blackhawks in 2010. On another front, we received a statement from John Doe's attorney this afternoon saying that John Doe feels vindicated from all of this. And then finally, I guess for Brad Aldridge, the former coach who allegedly assaulted the player, he's a registered sex offender in Michigan. Aldridge remains steadfast in saying his encounter with the Blackhawks player was consensual. And I've repeatedly asked law enforcement in Chicago, Ohio, and Michigan, where there have been numerous accusations against Aldridge, if they're investigating him criminally in light of the Blackhawks scandal. And the answer I've repeatedly been given is that they are not investigating him.
Tony, thanks for bringing us this update.
Thanks, Melba.
This the city of Chicago.
A lifeguard sex abuse scandal at Chicago's beaches and pools already has prompted the resignation of the park district's top executive. There is also an ongoing criminal probe by the Cook County State's attorney. Now, new details are emerging about who knew what and when. Documents obtained recently by WBEZ show the top 2 parks leaders were informed about, quote, wide-ranging allegations of potentially criminal misconduct more than a year ago. Joining us to discuss all this is investigative reporter Dan Mihalopoulos. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Mary.
There have been a lot of twists and turns to this story. What do these documents tell us that we didn't already know?
A lot of new and really significant details. This is a briefing that was prepared by the Park District's internal watchdog for the CEO and the board president way back in August of last year. It said there were already at that point in the investigation 34 park district employees facing allegations involving 10 public beaches and pools in Chicago. It said the accusers were as young as 17, the alleged perpetrators as old as 38, and that the accusers had made serious and possibly even criminal allegations of sexual abuse and also hazing and cover-ups. And before we got this document, we did not realize that the 2 top park leaders were being looped in so long ago about just how serious and widespread these allegations had become.
That was more than a year ago. Who got that information? What did they do with it?
So according to the documents we have, this briefing was prepared by the Interim Inspector General Nathan Kipp for Avis Lavelle, who's the Park District Board President, and Mike Kelly, who was the Chief Executive of the Park District at that time. Kelly and Lavelle took action against a few of the alleged perpetrators. They suspended at least three of them shortly after that report, but they kept this all under wraps, out of public view for 8 months. It only came out that there was even an investigation in April when we did the first story on it here on WBZ. In fact, the Park District only promised a bunch of changes after that story came out. And by that time, the Park District was already recruiting new lifeguards as young as 15 without telling them anything about this whole matter that was going on.
Now, Mike Kelly quit a couple weeks ago after Mayor Lori Lightfoot called him out. What's happened to the other parks leader who was briefed, Avis Lavelle?
Avis Lavelle is still the parks board president. She's well known in Chicago politics, having been close to former mayors Richard M. Daley and Rahm Emanuel, who put her on the Park District Board and made her the president. Mayor Lori Lightfoot has dodged questions about Lavelle's future in that position. And until yesterday, Lavelle had only spoken out once publicly about this scandal right after Kelly quit earlier this month. She said at a board meeting that she's committed to seeking the truth about the, quote, frat boy workplace culture at the Park District's beaches and pools.
And we will continue to do whatever it takes to root out and destroy that culture. We as a board and the Chicago Park District as a whole are taking each and every allegation seriously.
So Avis Lavelle, who you just heard there, has been the president of the Park District Board for nearly 3 years. She's been on the board for more than a decade, and she acknowledges there's a big problem there, but she says she will be part of the solution.
Briefly, Dan, what does Avis Lavelle and the Park District have to say about this, and what's next?
So I reached out to Avis Lavelle directly yesterday, and she said she did not specifically recall this briefing. She said she does not have the document, but she did not deny that she was briefed by the investigator at all. She told me, quote, it's possible he gave me a phone briefing. Otherwise, Kelly couldn't be reached. The mayor's office and the Park District spokeswoman declined to comment, citing an ongoing investigation. And as for what's next, there are police investigations into sexual abuse claims at the Park District and a state's attorney investigation that only started a couple months ago, many, many months, nearly a year, actually, after the inspector general reported to Lavelle and Kelly that this whole matter, quote, may necessitate the involvement of law enforcement.
Dan Mihalopoulos is an investigative reporter here at WBEZ. You can read the whole story at WBEZ.org. Thank you, Dan.
My pleasure.
This jersey that we wear today, it doesn't say Red Sox. It says Boston.
Since the violent resistance to school desegregation in Boston in the 1970s, thousands of black residents have fled south to escape racism. Now, with Boston poised to elect its first mayor of color, how do they feel about the city? GBH Radio's Philip Martin traveled to Atlanta to ask that very question.
Kyle Wells has lived in several cities, but he calls Atlanta home. He grew up in the Mattapan section of Boston along Morton and Blue Hill Avenue, and by the end of high school, was itching to go elsewhere.
I remember distinctly for my kind of high school goal was to move out of Boston.
Wells headed southward to attend college in the 1990s. Today, at age 49, he works as a senior creative writer for a major sports network here in Atlanta. We speak in his expansive front yard on the city's southwest side, where a huge magnolia tree shades his house from the hot Georgia sun. Wells stays in touch with friends in Boston and has been watching the mayoral race from a distance. He says he was disappointed when neither of his preferred candidates, Kim Janey or Andrea Campbell, advanced.
The fact that neither of the black candidates made it through, I'm not surprised. For blacks, there is still a perception. We're minorities, but we aren't the ideal ones.
And this former Bostonian seems unimpressed that one of two non-white female candidates is poised to take over the reins of city government. And so to the question, with Boston on the verge of electing its first mayor of color,
How do former Black Bostonians here feel about the city they left behind?
There is no comparison.
49-year-old Chantrice Sims-Holloman has lived in Atlanta longer than she lived in the Boston area, which she left in the mid-90s. Sims-Holloman grew up in West Newton and says it was there that she was first called the N-word. In Boston itself, she learned to stay out of certain neighborhoods, she said, because of the color of her skin. An author and educator with a doctorate degree, Holloman found professional opportunities in Boston to be far and few between.
My mother very much wanted me to move back home, and I told my mother it's important to me that my daughter grow up in a city where people look like her and are successful. My parents are still the only Black family within 3 or 4 miles of where they live. Here in Atlanta, there is Black excellence on just about every corner.
Logan Gaskill agrees, yet he is also encouraged by Boston's mayoral race.
That's progress.
Like a lot of Black professionals in Atlanta, Gaskill came here from the Boston area to attend Morehouse or Spelman. His father taught at Hyde Park High School during the height of desegregation, and Gaskill says he has watched over and over again video clippings of racial violence that erupted at the school in 1974. Yet, says Gaskill, he is still put off by people who seem to view Boston only through the prism of that period.
I moved to Atlanta for college, and I met a guy from Alabama or Mississippi, and he said, "Where are you from?" I said, "I grew up in Boston." He said, "Oh my God, it's racist there." And I just remember thinking, like, dude, you're from Alabama or Mississippi. Like, it doesn't get more racist than that.
But Gaskill says that perception is reality for many Black people in America, and that whoever becomes mayor of Boston will be tasked with updating that image. Atlanta native B. Maynard Scarborough worked for the city of Boston and the Globe, and famously carved out a space for Black and Latino people in the city's segregated nightlife by working with club owners and restaurateurs.
We did those things because we had to. We didn't have anything to do. So we were a natural group that needed just a little organizing.
Scarborough's enterprise was called The Loop. Most observers viewed it as a model of success for providing access to the city's often closed-off institutions of culture and nightlife. Yet Scarborough moved back to Atlanta in 2005 for reasons that he says are fundamental to the notion of basic freedom.
Atlanta is almost like we feel like we don't have to ask to do. You feel empowered. It's our town. I never felt, even though I was there for 20 years, I never felt like Boston was my town at all. And I love Boston.
George Chip Greenwich grew up in Boston's Mission Hill in Cambridge and has straddled the Mason-Dixon line via Delta Airlines for more than 3 decades. We're talking inside a cafe in Boston's Nubian Square. Greenwich also loves Boston, but says his heart is in Atlanta.
I was very interested in being in both of those spaces and places. In Atlanta, there are more opportunities for people to actually become an entrepreneur. There are more ways for creatives to be creative because there are more spaces to do so. And also, there's a cheaper rent district and arts district. Here, it's very impossible for a young person that's not in school to actually make it.
Greenwich created and runs a nonprofit called Greatest Minds, tasked with building the next generation of Black leaders in Boston, which achieved majority-minority status in the 2000s. Greenwich left Boston in the 1990s to attend Morehouse, but has lived in both Boston and Atlanta since then, and is now pursuing a PhD at Georgia State. Greenwich recently hosted a live debate in Dorchester with Michelle Wu and Anissa Asabi George.
These two candidates are younger, but I think there's some older structures that have to be addressed. Both have to make sure that there are resources on the table for people looking at the quality of life issues, why they should stay here and be around here.
Back in Atlanta, we asked Black residents if they would consider returning to Boston permanently in light of its changing political leadership.
No. I don't even have to think about that.
Chantrice Sims-Holloman cites the seemingly interminable racial battles over Boston exam school admissions as an example why.
I've gotten used to my daughter graduating from math science magnet school. There's just a difference where there's certain battles you don't have to fight.
Logan Gaskill is also not planning to return to live in Boston anytime soon, despite what he sees as political progress with this year's mayoral race. He's concerned about those who've fallen through the cracks of Boston society.
I would like to believe it's gotten better, but I mean, I think about this story that the Boston Globe did about why do people think Boston's racist, and they did more stats to kind of show like wealth gaps and jobs, and I don't know that Boston has done anything to dispel that.
Those interviewed agree
that Atlanta is far from a paradise for black people, with its high poverty and crime rates, class divide, and blue political status in an ocean of deep red conservatism. They also acknowledge that racism is omnipresent in the U.S. But here, these former Bostonians feel more cushioned from racism's impact. Boston's mayoral race is unlikely to change that perception. In Atlanta, Philip Martin, GBH Boston's local NPR.
March 1981. The city of Atlanta is gripped by one of the most appalling series of murders in U.S. history. Week after week, month after month, the dead bodies of poor young blacks, mostly children, both boys and girls, some as young as 8 years old, turn up in rivers, alleys, and wooded areas of the city and its environs. Atlanta, anxious to refashion its image from heart of the Confederacy to jewel of the New South, becomes a seething cauldron of panic, fear, and rage.
This week, the Atlanta Police Department hand-delivered evidence from the Atlanta child murders case to a private lab in Utah that specializes in analyzing deteriorated DNA. The evidence in these cases, 40 years old. The technology for DNA testing was not available back in 1982 when a jury found 23-year-old Wayne Williams guilty of two of the killings. But to this day, some remain skeptical that Williams was responsible for all the murders of dozens of black children across Atlanta. Lou Arcangeli is retired from the Atlanta Police Department. He was deputy chief and a detective on the case. When we spoke earlier today, he started by taking us back to the technological challenges of solving these crimes some 40 years ago.
You know, of course, DNA at that time wasn't really a part of police work. You know, we dealt with fingerprints, witnesses, and blood. With the Wayne Williams case, we began to deal with fibers. Detective Bob Buffington found fibers on victim Eric Middlebrooks, and it transformed our evidence collection at the crime scenes. You know, so the evidence that they're going through now is looking at that same, those things that were collected from the crime scenes in 1979, 80, and 81. But Emil, please take into account that DNA evidence and DNA strands are fragile. The likelihood of getting DNA evidence off of 40-year-old evidence that hasn't been contained in a very climate-controlled setting, a sterile setting, is very small.
What do you think are the strongest pieces of evidence against Wayne Williams?
The strongest evidence against Wayne Williams was presented at trial. It's over 600 pieces of fiber evidence. There was blood evidence presented in two of the pattern cases. And of course, then there were six eyewitnesses who linked Wayne Williams to victims right before they went missing and were subsequently found murdered.
There have been many documentaries and podcasts and movies made about these crimes. And you've taken issue with how the Atlanta Police Department and detectives are characterized in these portrayals. Tell us what your concerns are about how you and your colleagues are portrayed.
Well, a number of the documentaries and what I call mockumentaries, you know, portray the police as inept. Some of them go so far as to say that the police did not care about young black victims. And both of those are not true. The colleagues I worked with paid careful attention to detail. My colleagues were shaken by these crimes. It was difficult to work a homicide of an 11-year-old boy. I saw one of those victims in the Atlanta morgue, and it shattered. I mean, it was, even now, I remember seeing that skinny little boy, and it bothers me. We cared about these victims. And so many of the documentaries have explicitly said the police didn't care about young black men, or elected officials didn't care about the poor, you know, black men who were being victimized. That wasn't the case. Maynard Jackson petitioned the President of the United States for FBI support. The documentaries did not accurately describe what was going on in the Atlanta Police Department or in the Atlanta political scene. It was unprecedented at the time for the FBI to get involved in a local homicide investigation. Unprecedented. It had never happened.
As you kind of wait for the results or what outcome you may have from those DNA tests, are you hopeful that it may be able to answer questions that you still have about these cases?
I'm hopeful that this DNA review will reveal additional facts There's been so much interest in this case over the years, you know, that additional confirmation would be helpful. It might finally convince some of the naysayers, you know, that Wayne Williams is completely 100% guilty. Remember, this is not the first time that DNA has been analyzed from this case. In 2007, there was an analysis done on both hairs found from one of the young black male victims and the dog hairs that were found on many of the victims. The DNA analysis of the human hair that was found inside the shirt of one of the young black male victims came back as having a 98% chance of belonging to Wayne Williams. The dog hairs that were found came back with a 98% chance that those dog hairs were from Sheba, the Williams family dog. It was a mathematical certainty that Wayne Williams was guilty of having killed at least 12 people.
Mr. Arcangeli, thank you very much for your time and your insight.
Good day, sir.
Carry me back to old Virginia.
The people who organized the deadly Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017 are going on trial. Jury selection starts today. This is a civil trial, not a criminal one. The plaintiffs want to dismantle these extremist groups by bankrupting them. Here's NPR's Odette Youssef.
Violence motivated by hate has always been a part of America's history. So, too, has been a failure of the criminal justice system to deal with it effectively.
For reasons ranging from ingrained problems in our legal system that have to do with long histories of white supremacy to all kinds of procedural problems that have derailed justice in one way or another.
That's Kathleen Ballou, author and historian at the University of Chicago. She says that as a result, the civil courts have been important. In the 80s and 90s, the Southern Poverty Law Center won several landmark cases on behalf of plaintiffs against the KKK, Aryan Nations, and white Aryan resistance. The million-dollar judgments ended up putting many of those groups and individual extremists out of business. Scott McCoy is a lawyer with the SPLC.
They had property, physical land, and they had buildings and bank accounts that could be seized and taken. It's harder now in the digital age because a lot of these groups don't have those kind of assets.
McCoy speaks from firsthand knowledge here. He and his team have been trying to collect on a $14 million judgment they won 2 years ago. It was on behalf of a woman in Montana whose family was targeted by an anti-Semitic harassment campaign. The defendant, Andrew Anglin, runs a neo-Nazi website. He's also one of those named in the Charlottesville lawsuit. McCoy says the difficulty collecting from Anglin illustrates one new modern-day challenge to the classic playbook of suing extremists out of business.
Their assets are in cryptocurrency, and it's much harder to find and get at and attach those kind of assets.
Still, there's no doubt that these civil cases can disrupt extremists' activities. Richard Spencer has said as much. He's the white nationalist who coined the term alt-right and is among the defendants in the Charlottesville case.
Look, this lawsuit that I'm facing is just totally detrimental to what I'm doing.
Spencer said that on a far-right YouTube channel. He was talking about why he didn't accept an invitation to speak at a conference.
Look, if we can just simply be sued if anyone on the other side gets hurt, we can't do anything publicly.
People were more than hurt in Charlottesville 4 years ago. One woman was killed, and the nine plaintiffs in this case say they continue to struggle with physical, psychic, and emotional damage. Whatever judgments they win in this case may never make up for that. But Karen Dunn, one of their lawyers, says that's not her client's only goal. The fact is, the deadly events in the summer of 2017 were actually the second time that year that white nationalists and neo-Nazis had descended on Charlottesville.
One of the most striking facts to me in this case is that Charlottesville was really Charlottesville 2.0. That's what it was called. It was called that because there was a Charlottesville 1.0 and because there was every intention for there to be a Charlottesville 3.0, which did not happen in part because of this case.
Regardless of whether a single dollar can be recovered, experts and lawyers say winning substantial judgments in this case is crucial. Because this is the trial that will set the narrative about what happened in Charlottesville 4 years ago and reinforce a norm that Americans will not tolerate hate-motivated violence on their streets. Odette Youssef, NPR News.
I'm sure you've heard, across the country, protesters have been disrupting school board meetings over masks, vaccines, and the teaching of American history. The problem has gotten so widespread that the Attorney General is directing the FBI to help. But as NPR's Anya Kamenetz reports, what happened at a school board meeting in California last month is far beyond what's been seen anywhere else.
The Poway Unified School District in San Diego County was planning a pretty typical school board meeting this September, hearing reports from student representatives, honoring their teachers of the year. Because of the pandemic, the general public is asked to join and comment via live stream. But that hasn't stopped protesters from showing up in person. Darshana Patel is a member of the board.
The Let Them Breathe, anti-CRT, recall Governor Newsom, they're kind of a catch-all group of protesters. It wasn't the first time that they were there. They had been there several meetings in a row.
Anti-CRT means opposed to critical race theory, which has become the rallying cry for right-wing objections to how race and history are taught in schools. And Let Them Breathe is a California-based group opposed to masks and vaccine mandates.
In the August meeting, they were pounding on the windows. So little by little, it's been escalating.
In September, they got through the doors.
We were just coming out of closed session, and we heard a loud kind of ruckus downstairs in the atrium.
No one's doing anything wrong, as you see. We're all just standing, waiting for the people we elected.
All right, so the cops are here.
The people that we pay.
An elaborate video posted to YouTube shows the protesters waiting in a downstairs meeting room.
They were shouting and throwing verbal assaults at some of our staff members that were downstairs. They were accusing them of certain things, threatening them.
Patel and her fellow board members decided that the best way to de-escalate the situation was to immediately adjourn the meeting. Here's a clip from the local ABC affiliate.
We have been advised by law enforcement to adjourn this meeting at 7:11.
But the night didn't end there. The protesters came upstairs into the board's now empty meeting room. And then this happened from the same YouTube video.
They have not adjourned the meeting. So we are the people, so we can go ahead and replace the board.
Good.
So let's take a vote. Who's willing to become the president?
A man steps up in a Let Them Breathe t-shirt with a yellow smiley face on it, with no mask on, of course.
You may be the president. What's your name?
Derek.
Derek Rossi.
Greco.
Greco. Who's in favor of voting for Derek Greco to be president of the school board?
Aye.
Here's a selfie video Greco shot later that night and posted to Instagram. He's breathless and sweaty.
Hey, good evening, everybody. Had a pretty interesting night here at the Poway Unified School District board meeting.
NPR could not reach Greco for comment. He and the others who had just declared themselves the new school board voted to remove critical race theory from the school, which is not being taught, and to stop requiring masks. Later, Greco and four others filed notarized oaths of office with the San Diego County Clerk.
And we voted in a new board. You were looking at the new president of the Poway Unified School District, apparently.
It was very disturbing and unsettling.
To be clear, none of what happened on September 9th was legal or legitimate in any way. In his video, Greco invokes the idea of constitutionalism, which is a far-right ideology that means, in essence, that people don't have to recognize any laws or authorities that they don't like.
It's a national effort. They use social media to fan the flames.
Melissa Ryan is a consultant who tracks right-wing extremism.
It is basically the same groups and funders that were funding the Tea Party, and frankly, it's the same tactics.
Let Them Breathe's founder is Sharon McKeeman, a mother of four.
I had been part of the school reopening movement, and once my kiddos were back in school, I could see they still weren't back to effective in-person education because of the forced masking.
Let Them Breathe is a fairly new group, but they've grown fast. They've raised nearly $160,000 in the past 3 months on GoFundMe.
We are in the middle of legal action against California's mask mandate.
They also have a podcast that's broadcast on a San Diego conservative radio station. They have a professional videographer to record their events and produce what they call mini documentaries.
We had a smile fest. We had a couple marches that were really positive, full of kids, and just to help the community come together.
On its Instagram page, Let Them Breathe has promoted dozens of mask choice rallies at school board meetings all over the state of California, including the September one at Poway. But McKeeman says their organization doesn't tell anyone at those meetings how to behave.
Any parents that attend a school board meeting, that is a public meeting. It's not a Let Them Breathe event. So their dialogue, their actions, that is all a personal, their personal decisions, their personal responsibility.
Patel calls the whole thing surreal as well as anti-democratic. She has a PhD in biophysics. Her family moved to San Diego from the Bay Area when they were expecting their third child, so she could take a step back from her career and spend more time with family. But instead, she found herself drawn into public service. And now she's coping with a situation that seems completely irrational.
Ever since the beginning of public education, where there have been school boards, we've had passionate parents come in and give us their opinions and defend their children and speak to their rights and their values. We expect that. We welcome it. This is a whole different level.
The San Diego City Attorney has assigned a prosecutor to investigate what happened. Two protesters were arrested for trespassing at the October board meeting. Patel says her staff is still afraid of holding a meeting that's fully open to the public because they don't know what's going to happen next. Anya Kamenetz, NPR News.
Why haven't you learned anything?
Many schools across the country are also grappling with ways to close the achievement gap between white students and students of color. Special correspondent Fred DeSam-Lazaro has a report on those efforts in Minnesota, a state with some of the greatest disparities. It's part of our ongoing Race Matters coverage and Fred series, Agents for Change.
Remember, it's just like multiplication.
It's a busy Monday in Thetis White's fifth grade class at Monroe Elementary.
See, I knew I made a mistake somewhere because this was it right here.
Math, English, and even some history, all before lunch.
Because we're looking for all those words.
White's class in the Minneapolis suburb of Brooklyn Park is an outlier in this state, highly diverse, and taught by a black male.
I grew up in Minnesota. I had some very impactful teachers, black, white. When I say that, though, I didn't have my first black teacher until I was in seventh grade. All through my education, I had three teachers of color.
Circle it, because that's the word that you're looking for.
Even today, fewer than 1% of teachers in Minnesota are black men. White's own teaching career started less than 3 years ago, after working for UPS and spending more than a decade as a youth football coach.
Use your imagination.
He eventually connected with Black Men Teach, a nonprofit that works to recruit, prepare, place, and retain black males in school.
I really want them to understand that, you know, especially for some of my African-American students that are in my classroom, that you can be whoever you want to be, but you do have to have someone there that maybe looks like you, letting you know that it is attainable.
Experts say the low number of teachers of color contributes to wide educational disparities in Minnesota. The state has historically ranked near the top in test scores and graduation rates, but those numbers mask wide differences between white and in particular black students.
This year, about 52% of white students met state standards for math, compared to 18% of black students. And on reading, 60% of white students were proficient, double the percentage of black students. Nehemiah Johnson is a fifth grader in Thetis White's class. He used to go to school in the Minneapolis Public School District, but his parents wanted something different.
All his teachers were older white women, and I felt every day with him that I would have to encourage him to ask for help. You know, don't be intimidated, don't be nervous, don't be scared. It was more like he was uncomfortable.
But with White, Nehemiah has found confidence.
He helps me on my work and in math and reading.
It's good to see that someone cares. A black male teacher is showing that, expressing he cares about him. It probably would have helped being that age, having a Mr. White. It definitely would have helped me.
University of Minnesota professor Justin Greenidge studies racism and inequality in education. Growing up here, he says he didn't have a single teacher of color until college, and understands from his own teaching experience why they're so difficult to recruit and retain.
I would go up to a teacher and introduce myself about three or four times. They assumed I was security staff. it impacted my mental health because I started to like say, okay, how are people perceiving me? Should I even be a teacher? And I kind of got this complex like, oh, I'm not good enough. And so that's a subtle example, but like those things can accumulate.
Among the systemic challenges, Greenidge says public education dollars are not distributed equitably between the state's poorer and wealthier school districts.
There's been wide societal inequalities that have existed for decades, and schools and classrooms don't exist in a vacuum. Students of color in particular are put at a disadvantage because schools don't necessarily function to close those gaps in any meaningful ways.
In recent years, lawmakers, educators, and researchers have searched for ways to close the gap. One effort is being led by two prominent figures in Minnesota, Alan Page, a former Minnesota Viking, NFL Hall of Famer, and retired state Supreme Court Justice, and Minneapolis Federal Reserve President Neil Kashkari. They've proposed an amendment to the state's constitution. The current language requires a general and uniform system of public schools funded by the legislature. The amendment says all children have a fundamental right to a quality public education and that fulfilling that right is a, quote, paramount duty of the state.
It puts children first. Our current constitution focuses on the education system and funding of that system. Doesn't say word one about children. But we think it's important that every child, no matter what their economic circumstance, no matter what the color of their skin, no matter their ability or disability, can learn. And our proposed amendment shifts the focus to individual children.
Under the amendment, the state would set standards for a quality education. Parents who feel they aren't being met can seek remedies in the courts. But critics say that would only delay reforms. Denise Specht is the president of Education Minnesota, the state's largest teachers union.
It would require groups getting together to define things like quality. I do get a little worried when we are looking at a solution that is dependent highly on lawsuits. We see the urgent needs of students right in front of our faces right now.
Specht says the state could take more specific and immediate action.
I actually wouldn't mind if we were talking about a constitutional amendment that would specifically call for lower class sizes in our schools, or universal health care for every student, universal pre-K for every student. Those are the things that we know are affecting the gaps right now, and I think we have to get down and figure those out.
Many critics say fixing the state's education system does not require a constitutional amendment.
The argument being the solutions ought to be legislated, not litigated.
There were probably those people that said that about Brown versus the Board of Education. There are probably people who say that about a woman's right to vote. There are probably people who said that about freed slaves' right to vote. If we weren't in the position we were in and the current constitutional language was working, we wouldn't be here having this conversation.
The amendment has some bipartisan support, but it's yet to pass the state legislature, which is required before it can be placed on the ballot. Amid the debate over reforms and how to enact them, there's little disagreement on the importance of teachers like Thetis White.
This makes me emotional even thinking about it. I just really hope that somebody's going to see this and be turned into wanting to become a teacher, because we do need African-American teachers. They just have to want to step up.
Closing the education gap in this state may depend on it. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Fred DeSamlazaro in Brooklyn Park, Minnesota.
And it's all about supporting HBCUs!
Tonight, students at Howard University fed up with what they are calling unsafe living conditions. Student videos showing what appears to be pipes burst, insect infestations, and mold under beds and covering the walls.
Coughing up blood. Like, I was coughing so bad I coughed up blood. Like, coughing for hours. Great.
Students we spoke with say the mold is growing throughout the halls of the university dorms in Washington, D.C.
Are you guys in the same building?
No, no. I live in...
Because they're in different buildings.
Yes. Yes.
Two buildings, both of you coughing up blood.
Yeah. Yeah.
Both students are now living on the floors of the university cafeteria. Other students sleeping outside in tents and in sleeping bags, reporting to the university and posting on social media issues ranging from Wi-Fi connection problems to insect and rat infestations, like sophomore Tia Scott.
My own room, we had a mice infestation with blood everywhere and everything. It was a horrible situation.
Scott, now among the nearly 100 who have vacated their rooms, according to the students we spoke with, she is camping outside for a second week.
Right now, sleeping in a tent outside in the cold at night, trying to study for my midterms and keep my grades up while all of this is happening.
Students now calling out the administration.
I'm paying $5,000 for mold in my dorm. I'm paying $5,000 for rats.
Even leaks in their dorm rooms.
How many students do you think then are exposed to this right now?
Hundreds.
NBC News could not confirm the number, but Howard University did not respond to our request for an interview today. Last week, the university issued a statement saying, in part, members of the administration have also toured and inspected every residence hall on campus and are addressing any documented facility issues directly with our third-party housing managers. The results of our inquiries affirm that the issues are not widespread. That hasn't been enough, though, to satisfy many students. Another one of those students, Tamira Kelly. She is a freshman from out of state. She says she has no family nearby or anywhere off campus to move.
Most of my shoes in my closet, mold on my clothes, mold in our air vents, mold on my fan. There is mold everywhere.
You were breathing mold.
I was breathing in mold, and as someone with asthma and respiratory issues in general, that was terrifying. I couldn't stay in there. My parents didn't want me in there, so I had to get out of my room.
Vaughn joins us now from Washington. Vaughn, we saw there in your report you have students sleeping in the cafeteria, students sleeping outside. The weather is starting to turn in that area. It's only going to get colder. It sounds like they've hit a breaking point. How long are they going to be sleeping in those conditions?
Exactly. That's the question that these students have. We're talking about a second week for them between the cafeteria and outside here. But they said that they need answers from this administration. They said that they have requested a meeting with administrators, but have yet to get one. NBC News, we today reached out to those administrators requesting an interview. We ourselves have not heard back either. But this is the circumstances in which they said it is just as much of a necessity to be sleeping outdoors as it is a protest. And what this has become, these students who did not know each other before this, between going from midterms and classes, now are coming together discussing how they can best address this because they don't believe particularly the situation around that mold has been addressed. And they said they're not prepared to go back to those dorms yet. Tom?
The man not. Race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
Jury selection continues in the trial of three white men charged with murder in Brunswick, Georgia. They claimed they'd been trying to make a citizen's arrest of Ahmaud Arbery, a 25-year-old black man shot while jogging in February of last year. Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, said in the many difficult days since her son's death, May 10th was a good day. That's when Georgia repealed its citizen's arrest law.
Ahmaud was killed because of hate, because he wasn't committing a crime at all. And now we have the repealing of the citizen's arrest law. It's bittersweet that Ahmaud had to lose his life to get these type of change, but I'm very appreciative of it.
That law and others will weigh on this trial. I spoke about it earlier with Joseph Margulies, a law and government professor at Cornell University, starting with the history behind citizens' arrest laws.
Well, in fact, citizen arrest laws date back in their original form long before the founding of this country, when the police were not widely present. Georgia, like other states, allowed citizens to arrest someone that they suspected reasonably of trying to escape from a felony. And Georgia's law, its old law, dates to 1863, and it was basically a catching a fleeing slave law.
So it was grounded in racism from the very beginning?
No question. Absolutely. It is a legacy of a racist past.
How did the law factor into the behavior of Travis McMichael, his father Gregory, and their neighbor William Bryan, who are charged in Arbery's murder?
Well, the question that the jury will have to consider is whether the McMichaels and Bryan reasonably suspected that Arbery had committed a felony and was trying to escape.
And if they did reasonably believe it under the old law, would they have had authority not only to detain him, but to kill him?
No. See, so that's the second piece. once pursuing him, what happens? And that implicates a different Georgia law, which is still on the books, has not been changed, and that's the Stand Your Ground law. That and the open carry law in Georgia.
Do you expect this law to be a prominent part of the defense?
The combination of all three of them, that is citizen arrest, stand your ground, and open carry, are what's going to be at the center of this. Citizen arrest allowed the McMichaels and Bryan to chase Mr. Arbery. Open carry allowed them to be armed if they had a permit. And stand your ground allowed them to use deadly force if they reasonably, there's that word again, reasonably believed that they were at risk of serious bodily injury or death.
You wrote about this for the Boston Review last year, where you said laws like this sanction the predictable murder of innocent black men so long as the community judges it reasonable. Did Georgia's decision to repeal this law back in May fix the problem?
It went a long way. They eliminated the right of citizen arrest except for shop owners. That's a much more narrow, much better statute. It's a shame. No, it's more than a shame. It's a moral tragedy that we had to have the death of someone like Ahmaud Arbery before it happened. But yes, it's much better.
The death of Trayvon Martin in Florida almost a decade ago raised a national conversation about stand your ground laws, which are much more recent than citizens' arrest laws. Do you see the national conversation happening right now as similar in some ways to that debate almost a decade ago?
Similar, but also in the sense that it doesn't go far enough. Georgia repealed its citizens' arrest law as a result of the Ahmaud Arbery murder. But there is no move to weaken their stand your ground laws. Those remain on the books in Georgia and elsewhere. And as long as they are in place, you will continue to see avoidable violence on the streets.
Joseph Margulies is a professor of law and government at Cornell University. Thanks for speaking with us today.
Not at all, Ari. Thanks for having me on. Take care.
White woman, so-called Hispanic, got the job. She asked me about the Gabby Petito situation, and I played dumb like I didn't know. Like, I don't know too much about it, but of course I've heard about it because it was everywhere. And I was like, I think I heard something. And she's like, oh, I can't believe that you're not paying attention to this. You know, this woman is missing and blah, blah. And I'm saying to myself,
I traveled to Central Illinois investigating what led up to the discovery of this young graduate student's body more than 60 miles from his campus, found in a river in a city his family says was completely foreign to him. His family tells the I-team they will not rest until they know exactly what happened to Jelani Day.
This area is where they drove in.
This wooded area in the small town of Peru, Illinois, has become all too familiar to Jelani Day's mother, Carmen.
This trail here, somebody drove through here.
Right here, police found the one concrete clue in his disappearance, her son's car with the license plates removed.
My kids didn't come to Peru for nothing. Never was raised anywhere near here. Don't know anyone here. And Jelani would not have known to come and park his car in this wooded area.
The distance between where Jelani's car was found to where his body was found is another puzzling part of this mystery. From this spot, the I-team had to drive nearly 2 miles to the Illinois River, where investigators located Day's body. His mom says none of this makes sense.
How are you coping with all of this right now?
I've had to grieve while working and trying to find answers.
The search for answers leads back to the Illinois State University campus. August 25th, one of Day's professors reports he didn't show up to class, and he wasn't picking up his phone.
I didn't get any text messages back because usually that's our thing. He'll call me right back. That's the moment when I said something is wrong.
Investigators say Day was last seen on campus the day before, August 24th, at around 7:20 a.m. at the Student Center. And that same day at 9:12 a.m., this is the last known image of Jelani. He was spotted on surveillance video at a cannabis dispensary in Bloomington.
Our detectives were looking through electronic data, and this was really the last location that we had. Anything that's connected to, say, electricity or cell phone tower is something that we, the police, can look into.
But as for how his car got from here to Peru, Illinois, which is 60 miles north. That remains a mystery.
Right in here.
From where Jelani's car was located, we noticed a trail that leads to a nearby road.
I guarantee you my son didn't drive himself here. Whoever brought Jelani here, they were very familiar with this area.
Earlier this week, the LaSalle County coroner said Day's cause of death is drowning because he was found in the river and that there was no evidence of injury to the body. Day's mother is adamant. Anyone in the community who believes Jelani did this to himself is wrong.
Number one, Jelani knew how to swim. For them to imply that Jelani drove his car into this space, took it all the way over there, parked it, removed his license plate, then walked to where they're saying that his body was found a mile and a half away from here, and took off his shoes, his socks, and his shorts, and put himself in this water. Doesn't even make sense.
Day's mom says the license plates to her son's car and his phone still haven't been found. The family tells me they're demanding answers and justice.
I know that Jelani knows that no matter what he was doing, whenever he needed me, I was there. So I know now that he knows that I am going to be there and I'm going to find out what happened to him.
Now, the police departments on this case tell the I-Team they are working tirelessly to find out what happened to Jelani and are dedicated to providing the family with answers. But Jelani's mother tells me she feels she has received limited assistance from local and state officials and is initiating a third independent autopsy. She is pleading with the Illinois Attorney General and the FBI to take over this case and help her find out what happened to her son.
Now, everybody's like, jails ain't tough enough. Jails ain't tough enough.
Sit down.
I ain't used to this yet.
84-year-old Lester Pearson is strapping in a seatbelt across his body for the first time ever.
When I left the street, I don't think all the cars had seatbelts in them.
A half a century ago, they didn't. Man. The car pulls down the road. In the rear view, the place known as Angola, a former slave plantation that now serves as Louisiana's state penitentiary, slowly fades away. Driving the car is Andrew Hundley, Pearson's former bunkmate at Angola. He now runs the Louisiana Parole Project, which helps formerly incarcerated people reenter society.
This is the last time you have to look at this road.
When I come here, the road was a road. They ain't had no pavement on it.
It was a dirt road?
It was a dirt road. This road was so bad, you could walk beside the bus. That's how slow it had to go.
That was 57 years ago. In 1964, Pearson had just accepted a plea deal. The state said, plead guilty to murder and you'll be sentenced to life, but you'll be eligible for parole in 10 years and 6 months. And as long as you show good behavior, you'll be released. But Pearson never was.
After I did 10 years and 6 months, I wrote in, and I didn't get no answer from the warden or the government. So I just said, well, that's it, you know. They said life, so I figured, I said, well, that's what that means, life. So I'm not gonna go up there and worry about getting out.
He's one of roughly 60 men in Louisiana who took the same deal in the 60s and 70s that have remained in prison well past the dates they thought they'd get out. For decades, the deal they took, commonly called the 10-6 law, was frequently offered and honored. But in the 70s, while they were locked up, things changed on the outside. Politicians wanted to look tough on crime. They increased minimum penalties for life sentences, and by 1979, lawmakers in Louisiana got rid of any possibility of parole for people sentenced to life in prison.
They were purposely forgotten by legislators who wanted to appear as if they were being tough on crimes by literally moving the goalpost, which is patently and clearly unfair.
That's New Orleans District Attorney Jason Williams. Like other so-called progressive prosecutors around the country, he ran on a platform of criminal justice reform. One of his first steps in office was establishing a civil rights division. Part of its mission, address unfairly lengthy sentences and other examples of what he calls Jim Crow justice. The 10-6 lifers, as Pearson and his peers are referred to, were on the top of the list.
I think that the broken promises to black men and black people and people of color in the South, it was purposeful. There were very clear decisions.
Williams is the only DA in Louisiana reviewing these cases. For the roughly 40 of Pearson's peers who were convicted in other parts of the state, there's still no chance of parole. Pearson is the fifth 10-6 lifer from New Orleans to get out. At the time of his release, he was the second oldest incarcerated person from Orleans Parish. Now, at 84, he's about to re-enter the outside world. The car pulls on to Louisiana 66, the state highway that leads to Angola. Hunley's driving, Pearson's in the passenger seat.
This road is surrounded by the Tunica Hills and, you know, lush trees and turns, twists and turns, and then suddenly it opens up and you're at Louisiana State Penitentiary. The first time I drove this road, I was scared to death.
For the next few weeks, Hudley's organization will help Pearson get back on his feet. He's got a long list of medical issues. He's never used a cell phone or a debit card. It's a lot for Lester Pearson to take in.
Lester, I wonder when I left if you ever thought you'd see me again.
No, I never thought that. Never did.
Sorry it took 5.5 years, but I came back to get him.
I appreciate it. I've been locked up so long, I thought that would never happen. Especially going free, you know.
For the Gulf States Newsroom, I'm Bobby Jean Mizik.
Do you mind if we stay here a while, or must you go home?
There are no musts in my life. I'm free, white, and 21.
You're lucky.
The word rioters? Fine. Looters? Also fine. But there's one word the judge in Kyle Rittenhouse's murder trial does not want lawyers using to describe the people that he's accused of shooting and killing during demonstrations last year in Wisconsin. And that word is victims. The decision came down Monday, exactly 1 week before jury selection is set to begin in the closely watched trial. 18-year-old Rittenhouse faces homicide and attempted homicide charges for shooting three people last August in Kenosha. He pleaded not guilty, saying this was in self-defense. I want to bring in David Henderson, civil rights attorney, former prosecutor, and a CNBC contributor. Good to see you. So I want to read exactly what Judge Bruce Schroeder said. This is a quote. The word victim is a loaded word, and I think alleged victim is a cousin to it. He asked prosecutors to instead use the term complaining witness or decedent instead. The judge says that this is his longstanding policy for criminal trials, but on the flip side, he is going to allow the defense to call the three people who were shot rioters and looters. What do you make of this decision?
Chris, I've gotten a love for Kyle Rittenhouse, and it's easiest to think of this as a two-part ruling. Part number one, you can't call the people that he hurt victims. Part number two, you can call them rioters and looters. The first part of the ruling is correct, and the common thread uniting them is that, look, you can't mislead the jury on the law. At the beginning of the trial, he's innocent until proven guilty. You haven't proven a crime, so there is no crime victim. The problem is he's allowing the defense to mislead the jury on the law by referring to people as rioters, arsonists, or looters, because that wouldn't have given Kyle Rittenhouse the right to shoot them, even if they were participating in any of those activities, which they weren't.
So if you were a prosecutor in this case, how, if at all, would it change your approach with the judge?
Chris, if I was a prosecutor in the case, honestly, I wouldn't care, because you don't want to talk like a lawyer in front of a jury any more than you absolutely have to. Juries don't want to hear words like victim, complaining witness, decedent. These people are named Joseph, Richard, and Gage. That's how you want to refer to them. And if the judge tries to shut you down there, they need to have some righteous indignation in terms of saying, you said they can be called arsonists and looters. Why can't I call them by their names?
Understanding that this has sort of set the stage for the tone of this trial, tell me what you would expect to be watching for when it officially starts on Monday, and how does this affect, if at all, the way you approach jury selection? How do you expect jury selection to be approached?
I expect for the prosecution to be looking for a diverse jury. Typically on a jury like this, you want at least two people of color. I expect for the defense to be looking for people who believe in carrying firearms, because people who believe in carrying firearms believe they can use those firearms whenever they feel threatened. Now, with regard to the specific rulings that we've discussed, what's going to be more telling is when the judge chooses to sustain objections about people being referred to improperly, for example, as rioters or looters. Those terms should be used, if at all, in this trial during closing arguments. But I expect the defense to try to use them much sooner, including during jury selection, to try to pick jurors who favor their point of view.
So ultimately, as you look at this case and you know this case, what would you expect it to turn on?
I expect this to turn on whether or not people will accept that Kyle Rittenhouse had the right to use deadly force as soon as he believed that his life was being threatened. And let me be frank, Chris, this is a dangerous case. Out of all the cases in the news involving race that I see right now, I think this one is the hardest for the prosecution to win.
Dangerous how?
Because I think that people are simply too inclined to give weight to Kyle Rittenhouse when you look at the overall facts here in the case. One of the things, for example, that concerns me is the prosecution seems to favor the idea of allowing in footage and evidence showing that the police interacted with him before he started shooting people. That sends a very mixed message to a jury because it looks like the police endorsed him being out there. And for, in the mind of a jury, once you have him legitimately being out there, then it's much harder to argue he didn't have the right, from his point of view, to defend himself when he thought he was encountering deadly force. I don't agree with any of that. I don't like those arguments, but I'm smart enough to know those arguments are dangerous in a courtroom.
Got it. David Henderson, thank you. We appreciate it.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, October 30, 2021. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have observations, thoughts, questions you would like to share. The number to dial, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Few things to share, and then we will get to folks who dialed in with questions, observations. Number one, the neutralizing workplace racism for October 22nd. So not yesterday, the week before yesterday, there was an error with the audio, and it was not accurate. So people were not able to download the correct audio for neutralizing workplace racism for last week. That has been corrected some days ago. So if you were still wondering and where it was and what happened, should have been corrected. You should have easy option to just go back and check the file, download it again. Or if you listen online or what have you, go back and double check. Should be available without any errors, beginning to end. Neutralizing workplace racism, always important to have strategies, codification, really, to help solve problems in the workplace. Let's see. Before we even get to anything, obligatory PSA. So maybe it'll be said numerous times throughout the evening. Sobriety would be best. Now, generally, it will be younger folks. When I say younger, like teens, Kyle Rittenhouse's age, 20-year-olds who are out frolicking, you know, this entire weekend and have their costumes on and, you know, just go out and cut a fool. Sobriety would be best. I suspect there will be sobriety checkpoints this weekend, probably heading all the way into Monday, and I suspect just because I generally am left with the impression that a number of folks felt that they missed out on these festivities last year because of the Rona. So this time around, you know, they are not going to be denied, and they're going to do it to it, you know, for Halloween, as they say. So I would try to avoid being out and about. I think Dr. Kanban gives that suggestion in general. I would say especially these type of weekends, it's this holiday so-called in particular, because there's nothing really constructive about this. It's generally just a lot of excessive alcohol consumption, excessive consumption of refined sugars and sweets. We already have a big time obesity problem, so let's gorge on a whole lot of low-grade chocolate and highly refined processed high fructose corn syrup and all the rest of it. Yes, let's gorge on all that. After they've said for 2 years basically at this point, seems like it could be some sort of correlation between COVID-19 and obesity. Ah, give me some candy corn. Where are those Snickers? Man, you talk about foolish. I used to be a fool about some Snicker bars this time of year. Whew. Tubby for a reason. Don't even remember the last time I've had, like, for reals, I do not remember the last time I've had a Snickers. Leave those alone, too. Nothing but cavities and weight gain. Obesity. That right there. Diabetes. All kinds of problems with all of this. So hopefully you do not. That's another thing. If you are an attempted parent, like, try your best to not have your child engage in, because it's just nothing. I haven't seen anything constructive. I guess if you can figure out a way where you can make it where they're not eating all this nonsense, and it's not, it's disassociated, so much of it is just about violence and debauchery. I don't know. I've not seen what all of this looks like divorced from all of that. But if you can figure it out a way and make it constructive, have at it. If not, I would say try to avoid all this. It's best not to get this one started because it's got all that sugary candy. And then if you can dress up and, you know, go out in some sort of goofy costume, dressed up like a white killer or what have you. Remember, I remember, in fact, Breaking Bad, if folks remember, ancient history. I think the year that that show went off the air, which I believe was 2013, for Halloween, people were dressing up as the characters from Breaking Bad, which were meth-selling white killers. That was really popular. And then for the trick-or-treat, right, you got to give out something. As opposed to Snicker bars and candy corn, they were giving out blue candy that looked like blue methamphetamine from Breaking Bad. That's what I mean, like, the total, like, ethos, the spirit of white supremacy racism is right there. We talk about delectable Negro, all that chocolate consumption and everything, and the, talk about delectable Negro. But, I mean, it's right there with this, everything about this holiday. We're in the middle of what they call the dog food pandemic. They'll say opioid. All of this and impact on life expectancy and all the rest of it, even in the Rona, talking about people not being in treatment. And that was not that long ago, 2013. That's what they were giving out for Halloween, blue candy that looks like methamphetamine from our favorite show. Sobriety would be best. Alrighty, let's see. Some of the report, man, in the midst of all of the wackiness that's going on in the world, like, we didn't even, you know, get close to covering all of the many, many things that happened all over the known universe, much less the U.S., even, you know, Washington State, where I am specifically. All of the things that have been happening, we literally had multiple, I can't even say it was like just one person, we had multiple cows listeners. What happened to Albino Affairs, like, sending reports and what have you? And I even confess, like, man, I had found a report or two about Albino Affairs over the past few months, even going back to the summer, but there had been so many other things, you know, that happened that I deemed, you know, a pale rodent is not, you know, top priority given some of the other things that happened. And I mean, it could be said even this week, hey, an albino porcupine, how important is that in the scheme of all that happened over this week? But albino affairs, Dr. Welsing, they're for a reason. I did hear that those albino porcupines, and they had a duo, they had crusty eyes and crusty noses, or one of them did. The other looked like it may have been hit by a vehicle. But they're both receiving round-the-clock care. I guess that's a metaphor, but I guess that means they're getting regular attendance for the crusty eyes and crusty nose, and they're accepting donations. Those are about to be the most, like, well-tended, well-funded porcupines in the history of North America. Like, I think that is a very safe wager for the conclusion of October. Albino porcupine, you had us at albino. Sign us up. Dump my whole wallet out right now. Albino affairs. Let's see. They had Callie Crosley, a black female journalist for WGBH in Massachusetts. She was giving her remembrances for the late four-star general Colin Powell, victim of white supremacy. She was talking about that's one of the few times I've heard folks who, of course, they have to bring up the black stain on his record, the weapons of mass destruction and all the rest. But that's one of the few times where I've heard someone who didn't really call him any names and said, hey, I didn't really agree with his stance either. Victims guaranteed qualification. However, you know, I'm not celebrating. In fact, I'm kind of sad that he's passed away. And she, you know, gave her thoughts about why he was important, even some of the things that he said, talking about racism, white supremacy, the Tuskegee Airmen. What is their legacy if not countering racism, white supremacy? Maybe I'm misinformed. World War II era. But the albino porcupine. Let's see. The metaphor, there were a number of metaphors used throughout, but they started right there with Colin Powell's segment. That Colin Powell was known for because he didn't rock the boat. I said, that's interesting. Even sounds like a plantational metaphor. We don't want to rock the slave boat. Make the niggers nauseous below. Plantational metaphor sometimes. President Obama, I think, was known as No Drama Obama. Isn't that one of the nicknames that they all called him? In addition to nigra. But I think No Drama Obama is how he was known. The late Pamela Evans Harris. You used to talk about that all the time. Chicago area resident. Let's see. Next, they talked about the misinformation at Facebook and how they may have been complicit in allowing some of the illegal activity, insurrectionists, at January 6th in Washington, D.C., and they said that there was no appetite for change. Reminded me of Delectable Negro. What do you mean exactly? No appetite for change. Meaning that individuals at Facebook, employees, likely individuals classified as white, they saw this at minimum inaccurate information, maybe even information that was fomenting insurrection and terrorist activity. And they decided not to do anything about it. I've had Facebook pages deleted for posting about criminal activity, posting where they had public officials being threatened. Mayor Lucas, Kansas City, saying, hey, we got to wear masks. And people said, we're going to lynch Mayor Lucas. I just posted about that and how they called him a nigger. And they deleted my Facebook account, gave me a stern warning. And you got people who are coordinating criminal activity, and they don't get banned and censored and fussed at and all the rest, put that cyber muzzle on you? I'm not surprised, Mr. Zuckerberg. So they're rebranding. It's not, they're going to call the corporate name is now going to be Meta, M-E-T-A. I thought Meta World Peace? Didn't he do the same thing? I'm not going to be Ron Artest anymore. I'll be Meta World Peace. They should make him the spokesperson. That way we don't think of Mark Zuckerberg, will think of Meta World Peace, NBA champion, Kobe Bryant's teammate. Let's see. I included the back-to-back segments on sexual abuse in Chicago. I tried to check like some of the major cities. I'll check regularly just to see if specific things that are happening in their area, they have any updates on Ed Burge and the like. Even though I said Ed Burge, man, that is a part of that terrorist legacy. They would take electrical prods and place them on the testicles of black males. They're supposed to be teaching that exactly in Chicago public schools right now and calling it what I just said, terrorism. Ed Burge is a veteran too. They should need for that veteran. Anyway, I played the back-to-back segments talking about the Chicago Blackhawks sports team and then the local Parks and Recreation where they had this big criminal activity with the lifeguards and all of this sexual abuse. And then they're hiring 15-year-olds, Parks and Recreation in Chicago, and not letting them know. Now, see, that sort of thing is consistent. Chicago Blackhawks, they had this information, didn't do anything about it. We're trying to get this championship, man. Sexual abuse. Get to that. We're trying to get this championship. Consistent. Even with the Boy Scouts, we didn't hear that clip this week, but they said not something going back 2013 or what have you. They're talking about going all the way back. They said 100 years. They said 100 years ago, they had files of child rapists in the Boy Scouts. They weren't turning these people in. They were concealing this information so it wouldn't get out, wouldn't make the organization look bad. This has been going back 100 years with the Boy Scouts. You see that sort of same behavior, concealing criminal activity of other individuals classified as white, especially about child rape. And you see that across the globe. This is normally about the time where that idiot, even what he said, he said, sobriety would be best. That's one. And then white people do not care about children. Chicago just happened to be our example for the week. But I mean, we picked Michigan a number of weeks ago, could have picked lots of them. Just happened to be Chicago for two this week. And you see the exact same patterns where once again, it can't be that this was ignorance because this was reported. It seems that there was great time and energy repeatedly put in concealing. Not that we didn't know. We want to make sure that other people don't find out about this. Not even that we're trying to stop it per se. I don't know. Maybe Parks and Rec, maybe they were trying to win a championship too. Maybe they had other priorities. Let's see. Got to talk to your children about racism and sexual abuse. They said 15-year-olds were being hired there and they didn't give them any information. Let's see. We had the segment on getting black teachers and the impact of having a black teacher, how that impacts especially black boys in the classroom. We've done whole programs on that. Travis Nichols was a guest way back, I think, 2015, black educator, Stanford University, and his research on why we don't have black male teachers specifically. That is one of the smallest group demographics with regards to teachers in the U.S., black male teachers. I think Young Academic has attested to that on neutralizing workplace racism, deliberate sabotage of a eager black. And they had the audacity to talk about, you know, we got to get folks who are excited to do this work and who want to come in and help. I don't think it's that you don't have black people, black males in particular, who want to be teachers. I just think that many, many black males are experiencing white supremacy racism in the classroom and they are being thwarted, sabotaged, just like what we talked with Young Academic. That's what I think the problem is. Same way, minimizing white supremacy racism and finding different excuses and things, or we can't find the talent. Same thing they were saying in the tech industry. They use the metaphor, it's a bottleneck, we don't have talent, we can't get people. No, I don't think that's it. I think it's white supremacy racism. And I think there's been so much. They said that white women, they had some of the black students talking about, oh man, it was such an impact finally getting a black male who happened to be named Mr. White. But that's exactly Breaking Bad. The teacher is named Mr. White. But anyway, he said, you know, previously him having these white female teachers and how that wasn't helpful and all the rest. In fact, that was even mentioned earlier. They had some of the folks who said black people who grew up in the Boston area and then they moved to Atlanta, they said to escape racism. I inserted the little bit of laughter there. That's so funny. Anyway, but some of them said one of the reasons that they wouldn't move back to Massachusetts is because, hey, my daughter is graduating in a magnet school. That would be a fight. That's what she said. That would be a fight. And I'm just not willing to have those battles for my child. Now, who wants to be in that sort of environment where you have to go and brawl and fight to have your child not be in special education or to make sure that they get access to the best competitive classes so that they can learn tons and go out, be competitive in 2022 and beyond? Like, who wants to be in that sort of environment? Anyway, but flashback. So they're talking about the importance of having black male students. Now, they said prior to Mr. White, he had lots of white women teachers. That right there is the beginnings of why you don't have black male educators, black educators, period. Things that are happening right there. K-12, when you have students who end up having a really bad experience, they get lots of terrorism. They don't think school is fun. They are discouraged about learning and being inquisitive. Psh, who's going to want to be an educator if that's what you think of teaching? If all you have is horrible memories of white women, racist teachers, who's going to want to follow in her footsteps? Beginnings of that are right there. It's not an ambition problem. Let's see. Ask Young Academic. Check the archives, in fact. You don't even have to ask. Or you could do both. Check the archives and ask him. Let's see. The HBCU, or specifically Howard, which is an HBCU, Washington, D.C., what I thought was important, because I've heard that before, where one of these so-called historically black colleges, they don't have the resources that they need to solve problems and be more competitive, really make all the amenities at the campus and upgrades that they'd like to do. One, they talked about endowments. We talked about the University of Michigan, where they did the same thing, concealed a rapist, sexual predator for decades. The University of Michigan has a $12 billion endowment. That's more than like double. I think that's like perhaps close to triple the total endowments of all of the so-called HBCUs is, I think, maybe a third of just the University of Michigan alone. And that's not even an Ivy League school. Anyway, that's one component that I thought about too. The other component, which I think should be mentioned every time, these schools are habitually robbed. NPR has done reports about this, as have many other mainstream outlets, about how they do not get the correct amount of funding, federal funding, that consistently is below what they are supposed to get. That is deliberate theft in a system of white supremacy. And then they have these types of problems, and they look, I mean, it was substantial. It was not, oh man, you missed out, you know, now you got to have a bake sale to make up for that $5 that you're missing out. It was like a substantial amount. And again, this wasn't a one-time thing, you know, that we so-called shortchanged you just in 2013. This was, the word I used was habitual. Codified, you might want to say, that we are not going to give you the funding, even though it's written out, this is what you're supposed to receive. You don't get that amount. You consistently get something lower than that amount. And then have these sort of problems and what have you. The lead is not, man, we have consistently been robbed. How about cut us a check to make up for the lost revenue and interest? And then maybe we can start solving some of these problems immediately. Generally doesn't work that way. Let's see. They had the segment on Lester Pearson. Aren't just playing songs to play songs. You can do that on your so-called free time. There is a song called Suspended in Time, which is about non-white people, black males and specifically, ended up being in greater confinement, and it's like you just get so detached from everything. They said Lester Pearson in greater confinement for 57 years. He agreed to be there for a decade, and this ends up becoming 57 years in Louisiana. And he talks about getting out of prison. They had the scene at the beginning. He's in the vehicle, and he said, man, when I, you know, used to be back in a vehicle 50 years ago, I think he said they didn't have seat belts, much less, you know, click it or you might end up being right back where you started the day out at, Mr. Pearson. Like, that's what the song meant, though. That was the metaphor, suspended in time, where, you know, you go to greater confinement in 1960 or whatever it is, and then you come out and so much time has passed. Like, I mean, wow. You just basic things. You think a seatbelt is a newfangled contraption. My goodness. Wait until you see a phone. Like, let me go get a five-year-old to show you her phone. I mean, it's pitiful in many respects. But I mean, that is by design in the system of white supremacy. But I mean, 10 years. 10 years. You don't get any of that time back. And that right there, you can probably go back and probably pinpoint to some white educator who contributed all of that, if you had enough information about Mr. Lester Pearson. But good old Louisiana always got a story down there. And they had a number of metaphors there, too. They said that Lester Pearson, him agreeing to a 10-year sentence and then ending up serving 57 years, where he could have easily died in greater confinement over that time. They said that this was an example of Jim Crow justice. I just mentioned that term last week. Like, you want to talk about words? They just added 455 words to the dictionary. Jim Crow should be permanently deleted from the attempted counter-racist lexicon. Non-white is almost 2022. There is no reason for the word Jim Crow to be used at all. All of this is white supremacy, and I mean really, 10 years, and they said deliberate. They knew what they were doing. So 10 years becoming 57 years, that is legal terrorism. Call things by their proper name. I don't know what Jim Crow is. I don't know what context that would be the most accurate phrase to use to describe what is generally done to black people, whether they're talking lynching someone, castrating someone, raping them, taking 57 years from their life. None of that should be minimized to Jim Crow. And then a lot of times what they'll do, if you're watching like black and white footage or some even a serious documentary, when they say Jim Crow, they'll cut to some black and white footage of someone dancing. Oh, Jim Crow, Jim. Call things by their proper name. That phrase should be totally removed. Like, do they want to talk about removing the N-word? Like, Jim Crow is way worse, because that's why you have a lot of these metaphors and people not really grasping what exactly are we talking about here? What exactly is the process? This is not vestiges, legacies of racism. This is white people deliberately. The term we use right now when we talk about the courthouse. Caller in Florida sent us pictures. They're dressed up in their Halloween costumes. Treachery. White people practicing racism, white supremacy, and being treacherous. See if we can steal 57 years from a black male. Lester Pearson this time. And they've done this habitually. I mean, Louisiana. Parchman. Angola. Infamous for doing this. Get some free labor. Brag about it. We put them outdoors at niggers. We don't have big industrial prisons out here. No way. Let's go out to the swamp and work. Anywho, slavery, that is. Let's see. I was going to say something about the Kyle and even the Ahmaud Arbery trial, but we will have time for all of that as we proceed. Listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Visit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPalButton.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you check below, you should see links for PayPal, Venmo, Cash App, the Cash App address, cash.app/$TheCows. Much obliged to all the folks who have invested, kept us on the air for 12 plus years. Hopefully we have provided constructive information on what white supremacy racism is and how it works. You can also hit the Amazon wish list. Whew, has been a tussle, but is working. Listed under Gus T. Renegade, also should be linked on the blog. Feel free to nab an item or two. Have my replacement phone there. Devastation of 2021, as well as an external sound card. I thought it was so cool. I had one using it, and then it didn't work. Either it was not working well to begin with, or it's not the one that, you know, it's going to be solve my problem. So I have yet another sound card at the top of my list. That would be awesome as well. What a year it has been. Persevere. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, questions, counter-racist observations, you can unmute yourself, share your observations, and then mute your line. That just keeps it so that we don't have a lot of unnecessary background noise. If you know you're in a noisy environment, if you kind of get to a quieter area, and then you can share your thoughts and then mute once everyone's had at least one chance to speak. And then if you want to unmute, you have other questions, observations to make, feel free. For this broadcast, if we could avoid metaphors, race soldiers, they are extra. Jim Crow, case in point, they're extraordinary at using metaphors to confound and confuse us. They said that they were going to get Lester Peterson after 57 years. They're going to get Lester Peterson back on his feet. What does that mean? I mean, really, like, give it to me like I'm six. What does that mean? They deliberately use those type of metaphors. And Jim Crow, after 57 years of Jim Crow, we're going to get Lester Peterson back on his feet. Racism alive and well. Those type of metaphors to confound our understanding, confuse us about what's happening. Often they'll take two separate entities and insist that these are identical, exactly the same. And frequently that's not the case at all. Victims, myself included, a lot of times we do not have all of the information. We're still learning. So sometimes, as opposed to logic, we will utilize a metaphor, analogy, comparison of some sort. Frequently, this just contributes more confusion. If we can make an effort to be precise, exact in our word choice, that would be super appreciated. Number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I took mental health days. I meant to say that. That was my cue to say that. I was taking mental health days this week. During my mental health days, I actually was watching the news, and in Philadelphia, brotherly love, Sioux Africa, they said they were commenting about a white man who I think is the head coach of their football team, the Eagles, and they said he should be fired. And they were in an uproar. I think the team did lose. I'm not sure, but I know the reason they were upset, he gave a press conference and was using confusing metaphors. It was so bad, they didn't even grouse or complain. All they did was play what he said with the metaphor. He said, I don't even have a comment. I think he should be out of a job. I almost was going to play it just like, man, those metaphors. I say that all the time, like, be mindful, because people can get really carried away with, you know, things that are being compared, or just their, you know, what they think are their really insightful figures of speech. And this happens frequently with white supremacy racism. But that did happen while I was taking some mental health days. I said I had not been feeling well at all. With all the craziness and hoopla and everything, I said I'm going to sit myself down, rest, get some ginger, lots of it, and get lots of rest, get my fluids up, and just take some mental health days. Happened, I guess if there is a good time to do all of this, the bomb cyclone was right here in the Seattle area, I think all up and down the West Coast, but I mean, wow. I walked outside Sunday, I think it was. Yeah, Sunday. I walked outside. It looked like there had been some sort of bombing or what have you. There was so much debris and tree branches just all over the road, and it was stunning. I could hear the rain. I just didn't know that the wind had accelerated so much. So in the span of, I think, 4 months in Seattle, we've had two different heat waves, or maybe 5 months. I think that would be within 5 months. We've had two different heat, or it's not even five, it's 4 months. Within the last 4 months, we've had two heat waves, a bomb cyclone, and it was 37 degrees at the beginning of this month, with again, coldest October ever. So if there were going to be mental health days, I think it was great to take them during the bomb cyclone, because wow, it looked really unpleasant being outside. I think they had, what is the brain damage? Sunday Night Football. I think that was here this past weekend. And wow, I was just looking at the weather like, my goodness, is that really happening outside? And then I stepped on the porch and was like, yes, that is, whew, man. Anywho, the number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see if folks have thoughts. Maybe we have someone who has a, let's see. First couple of folks who dialed in with hands up should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Retired fire. Oh my goodness. There's our med school student. Greetings, Emmy. Greetings, retired firefighter. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to everyone. DCS, we had a session today. Being that I'm in charge of the filming, the film we watched today was one of the many biographical documentaries on Minister Malcolm Shabazz. It was the one that was narrated by the great actor James Earl Jones with his deep voice. You had an early rap group that called themselves the Last Poets that performed on the documentary, and the great Billie Holiday and two of her popular songs, Strange Fruit and God Bless a Child Who's Got His Own. Got halfway through before, you know, we don't try to show them the whole, when it's something that's like an hour and a half or 2 hours long, we're not going to show them the entire movie and or documentary. We would show it in spurts of like an hour, 45 minutes, and then come back the next Saturday. They would take notes, and we would go over it and what we took. And I always create discussions with them to whereas instead of me doing a whole lot of talking, I think it's better to have them to talk and express themselves to each other and to myself. That works out pretty good. with each session. The next and last thing I wanted to report is a example of Nellie Fuller's monsters and monstrosities on the part of the toxic damage that has been done to non-white people who are racially classified as black. I don't know whether or not anybody knows about this particular report. I'm going to read it as quickly as I can. Hold on for a second. Three Florida teens will be charged as adults in death of high school classmate who was fatally stabbed and hidden in bushes. That's the caption. Three teenagers from Miramar, Florida, which is only about the area where this murder took place, was only about 3 miles from where I'm sitting at right now. Although I'm in Dade County, but I'm very close to the Dade County county line, within about a mile from it. And this location of this apartment complex is only about, I can get to that apartment complex in about 10 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes. We'll be charged as adults in the death of a fellow high school student who police say was found badly beaten, stabbed, and hidden in some bushes in his apartment complex. It goes on to state about what the Broward County State Attorney's Office decided it would do by charging the quote-unquote suspects. The three young people consist of one male and two females. Yes, two females. As adults, for formal charges expected to be filed in the coming weeks. An arrest warrant was issued for the three suspects on October the 22nd, charging them with first-degree murder, criminal conspiracy, and evidence tampering, according to Tanya Rue's Public Information Office for the Miramar Police Department. They are being held at the Juvenile Assessment Center pending trial. The victim was an 18-year-old. Police say the killing was premeditated, citing text messages sent between two of the suspects about a week before the stabbing that were disclosed in the arrest affidavit. According to the affidavit, the slain teen's mother had made contact with authorities on October the 19th after viewing surveillance video from her complex, where she said she saw two men beating her child while a female watched. Out of those quote-unquote two men, one of them ended up being a female. She told police she had not seen her son since October the 17th. The responding officer found evidence of blood where the alleged beating the mother had seen on the surveillance video took place and discovered the deceased teen in the bushes with a broken knife laying on the ground in front of the body, the affidavit says. I'm not going to go any more, you know, about this horrendous detail. I have actually, when I was working with the fire department, had been on, you know, many murders. The last one was actually based on a stabbing. And it takes, when you see something like that, what came to my mind was of the amount of energy that a person has to have to be able to stab and injure a body of another person in such fashion. You know, because we're talking about not a instrument called a gun. We're talking about with your own thrusting of your energy to stab this person to death. It takes a lot of energy, if I put it that way. But this is the reasoning on why I take the time to spend time around young people and sharing things that I learned with them, making suggestions to them, and offering myself and what background that they can deem as being constructive that they can get something from around, you know, to be around them for those purposes. It's vitally important, not just your own child or children, but other young people. It's essential. They need us to get involved with them. It's going to take some courage also to be able to state some things to them, with even the risk of you being a victim. It's going to take that, you know, at some point in times, you know, perhaps because the toxin is very strong. Without our involvement, it's only going to get worse. It's only going to get worse without our involvement at all. It's not just going to go away. And that basically is from my many years of observations of being in contact with young people. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. Sober reminder indeed. If anything, I take those type of illustrations. As you said, the toxicity is so high, that anti-blackness, that's just a part of the system of white supremacy. That's why I think Mr. Fuller has on the 10 stops, no name calling. That something is so small. It is amazing. And even I suspect with the incident that you're talking about, and those text messages and everything, I'm pretty sure the person who ended up being killed and tossed in the bushes, I'm pretty sure there was some calling that person by names other than what that person likes to be called. I don't know anything about it, but that's just a guess. Now, that's not why it happened or anything, but I mean, anything that we can do to minimize and decrease that, spending time investing young black people, trying to share constructive information with them, even having the courage to do so because they might be upset. The toxicity is high, as he said, but hey, it's just going to get worse. Television is a big part of that, and sobriety, like getting getting all kinds of poisons and toxins in the food, and then, you know, all the rest of it, that just makes things a lot worse. So yeah, it's not going to improve unless we get in and are willing to invest our time and energy to try to give correct concepts, a better way to use our time and energy, and just a better way to think about, you know, how I'm going to treat someone else who is classified as black. But man, sobering reminder, minimizing conflict with other non-white people. That is, I think I just said that yesterday, like that really, if you say that you're more informed about white supremacy racism, in my view, that's one of the major ways that you illustrate minimizing conflict, not mistreating other non-white people, especially black people. Let's see. Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. No spectators. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, the number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks with a hand up.
Hey, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hey, everybody. I'm calling from the 712 here. Yeah, we need to think about how we talk to each other. I was just around some of my friends and everything, and these are all black people, and there was some young black children there, and one of the older people came up to us, and we were by the black children, and it was a male, and he called one of the black girls ugly in a playful way. He said, "What's up, ugly?" And then she said, "Oh, nothing. What's up with you, ugly?" So they were just going back and forth. Now, little girl's about six, and the older person is probably like 26. And I didn't want to seem confrontational or anything, but I just said, you know, hey, she's really small. Do you think we should be, even if you're in a playful way, do you think you should be saying that she's ugly, and then she's saying it back to you? And then now both of y'all are ugly, and y'all really are beautiful black people. And I hope they understood what I said. They just kind of shrugged it off, like, you know, yeah, okay, I understand, but I don't know. We should think about stuff that we say that could stay with her. I told her that she could be internalizing that, even if it's just playful. She's really young, you know, and a lot of people grow up to do crazy stuff to try to compensate for. Maybe somebody did tell them they were ugly when they were younger. So I just wanted to throw that in there since you were talking about that. And I was listening. Thank you so much for having this for us every week. And I just wanted to say a couple things about the Chicago Blackhawk thing that they had going on with the sexual assault. The Chicago Blackhawk, whoever are in charge of whatever they do, they paid lawyers to investigate, to tell them that they didn't investigate sexual assault claims. It just doesn't make any sense. That is just, you pay somebody to do an investigation to tell you that you didn't investigate. They do stuff like that, like, all the time. I just want to point that out. And with the Atlanta child murders, that person that they were talking to, he kept wanting to really make it known that, you know, people were saying that the police that were investigating the case did not care about the children. And he really was trying to not drive home. I won't say that, but I'll say that he kept saying that over and over again I want people to believe that they cared about children. And even to the point where, you know, the FBI came in, and normally the FBI doesn't come in for murders. Well, sir, the FBI should have been called in. That probably was the work of what they call serial killer. So that's definitely FBI investigation. But the fact that it was small children, that the FBI should have been bought in. But he said it like, well, we went far and beyond and even bought the FBI in. Sir, you were supposed to be doing that. They don't really care about children. They just don't care about children. And the last one I want to talk about is with the neo-Nazi. They call the people the neo-Nazis. That report, what really stuck out to me, that report about they said they was so much money being exchanged and all this money, and it was through cryptocurrency that they said that is hard to trace. Now, going out and spending dollar bills, I might believe you with that, but not even now with 2022, there's too many cameras, even going out spending dollar bills. But you want us to believe that digital money cannot be tracked. I do not believe it. I won't believe it. And I don't care what they say. I study IT, and I work in IT, and everything can be tracked. And I thank you for listening to me, and I will mute my line.
Love it when you can be confident about things that you know. Love it. Because I think what they call it, gaslighting, where they will racists will try to convince us that we don't know things that are logical and accurate, try to convince us that that's not the case. Seems very logical to me that in this, it's almost 2022. Digital cryptocurrency, I don't think people would be talking about it as a serious mode of currency if it couldn't be tracked securely. What do I know? Ignorant, certainly not a financial whiz, as they say. Before I transition to some of the other folks who dialed in, I totally neglected to say anything about the segment on Wayne Williams, which I was almost not going to include. I guess, for one, I find it interesting. They have so many new reports, and I get it. I'm not 20. I'm not a teenager. So there are lots of people who are maybe just finding out about Wayne Williams and the so-called Atlanta child murders. It, you know, is, I was going to say not quite ancient history, but I mean, hey, we're talking about almost 50 years ago, this case. I find it interesting because I think they reopened one of the cases recently, and that had all been, I know there's no statute of limitations on murder, but I mean, it's nearly 50 years. I think at this point, some of the individuals who committed this crime might be deceased. 50 years, we don't have the best health care, especially in Georgia. We don't have the best health care, especially if you think any of these folks might be black people. Some of the, I mean, unless you think they were doing this in their like teens, 20s, and even then, but I mean, especially if you think these were folks were anything 30s and up, like very possible that some of these folks could be deceased or, you know, don't know what we're going to be finding 50 years later in this case. Any rate, we've done many programs. Our first program back on the air in 2009, Chet Dentlinger, who has since passed on, who worked on the original case at that time, guest on the program. He wrote a book, co-wrote a book about the case. We did a number of programs on the Atlanta child murders. I'm an Atlanta resident. Like, I found myself in Seattle, like, rooting for the Braves. I don't even watch baseball. I couldn't name one person on the team. And it's like, I could see myself like running down Peachtree as though this is, you know, going to help push us towards racism, white supremacy. But that's one thing that I did when I lived in Atlanta. I didn't research Atlanta Braves history, Hank Aaron. I researched the Atlanta child murders, so-called, and Wayne Williams. What I found interesting about that segment, words so important. Number one, they bring on, when I looked at it, it was they're getting the DNA tested, but he was speaking with so much certainty, it was as though they had already had the DNA tested. Like, oh yeah, we got the results back and he's guilty. It was like, oh, wait a minute, you all are getting this DNA tested. And even in the report, it said, hey, you know, temper your expectations. This DNA wasn't kept in the best circumstances in a sterile environment. As they say, it's been like 40 years or more, so who knows what kind of results we're going to get. He's speaking, Wayne Williams did it, he's guilty. It's so much to say about this case. That's why we've done so many programs. The minimum I'll say, words are so important. Wayne Williams was never even charged, much less convicted of any of the child murders. He was convicted of two individuals who are well over the age of 20. Now, I don't know what universe you're in where that would constitute a child in a legal sense. He is not a convicted child murderer. So if there was so much overwhelming evidence of Wayne Williams' guilt, why not at least charge him at the time? They didn't do that. So that's one. Even the language that's used to describe the case is incorrect, because you have children on the list. You have people that are in their 20s on the list. Like, what are we talking? Even we talked about that. Even the arbitrary nature of the list. There were so many, as there are now, black people, black males, black children who were missing and murdered at that time who did not get the Gabby Patino treatment. So, I mean, how many of these people are we saying Wayne Williams killed? All of them? Half of them? 10 of them? 5 of them? Again, he was charged with zero, not convicted, not even charged with a single missing child. That's another one that has a lot about child rape and sexual abuse. Well, we talked about all that before, but just the language that was used in the report, because even when he said the DNA results that they got back previously, he didn't say they got back DNA results of a black child. He said DNA of a black male, which I thought was interesting, because if we're saying these are the Atlanta child murders, did you test any of the children, or did you just test, you know, the DNA of these 20-year-olds? And I guess some people don't think he convicted any, committed any of these crimes. So if you just tested the DNA of the 20-year-old males, that's fine. But I just, even that is curious, because you're saying he's a child murderer. He is the guilty party in a case known as the Atlanta Missing and Murdered Children. That's not what we convicted Wayne Williams of, or they, in the state of Georgia. Incidentally, this case did get a lot of attention later. If you look at the details, it would be totally accurate to say, hey, they didn't get Gabby Petillo attention either, because these murders allegedly start in 79 officially, and this doesn't become a big deal until like 1980 or so. Muhammad Ali gets involved and a whole lot else, but for a while, this is, yeah, the same way it would be talked about now, not at all. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, callers and listeners. I thought the clip with the black male teacher was really refreshing to hear. Well, that's probably a metaphor, but really appreciated hearing the black male talk about his experiences in the educational system, which is very similar to mine and many other victims that I know. And I really appreciate hearing him. And I think the other, it was a white man, using the term, correct terminology as black male, calling people and persons what they are, using logical terminology. That was really constructive to hear. Also, the porcupine story, albino porcupine story, reminded me of the recent incident of the black male. Oh, it also happened to a black female recently as well, where they were ejected from hospital without the proper treatment. They're ejected and left on like a street curb with like the tube still tied into them. The black male, he still existing, but I think the black female passed away. And the story from that retired firefighter reported on reminded me of the recent case of Brian Coulter and Gloria Williams, where Brian Coulter, a white man, Gloria Williams, a black female, Brian Coulter killed her black male child, and the body was decomposing in their apartment for about a year. And the children, there's three other black male children inside the home with the decomposing body. And this is just an example of like the dangers of being with white people, or what it does to the mind and thinking capabilities of victims. It's just really, really tragic and very, very, very terroristic as well. Monsters and monstrosities, black people, white people globally, as long as we are in this system of white supremacy. And I would imagine that anything that is on a digital can be traced if white people really wanted to use their time and energy to do so. But they don't want to. This porcupines got treated more than got better care than the black people I mentioned being ejected from the hospital. And I'm pretty sure more time and energy was spent taking care of them than looking for a Jelani, that victim who was, I suspect, murdered. And did they also find him with his organs missing? I think maybe confusing victims, but I think he was also found with his organs missing, because that name Jelani sounds familiar, and I only know of Jelani who had their organs robbed. And I meet my line. Thank you.
White lives matter. Albino lives matter. That is, I'd much rather see that than Black Lives Matter signs, because I only see Black Lives Matter signs for the most part when it's out in the crowd or so after a black person has been killed or missing, both unjustly incarcerated. that sort of thing. I will have to check to see, because I feel like someone, I just read a report where they were talking about allegations of missing organs and the parent came out to refute. So I'll have to check. Let's see. If I can find it quickly, I'll share. If it takes some time, then we'll see if other folks. Oh, so this, I'm just going from the first report that I found. I'll take the AP News. I see this on other, I see it on other reports, but I'm just going to take the one from AP News. So this is October 15. Coroner's report says missing graduate student Jelani Day was found with his organs missing. That pop-up got in the way. I can't believe. Okay. Start again. Coroner's report says missing graduate student Jelani Day was found with his organs missing, including his teeth, eyeballs, and spleen. His jawbone was sawed out. AP's assessment, false. The LaSalle County coroner, who first examined Jelani Day's recovered body, said it was severely decomposed, but no body parts were missing. The coroner said the jaw was removed to assist with identification and that all parts of the body were returned to the family. The facts, the body of Day, who attended Illinois State University, was found in the Illinois River on September 4 and positively identified on September 23rd. Before the discovery of the body, Day had been last seen at the Illinois State campus on August 24, according to reporting by the Associated Press. Confusion around the initial autopsy report, a second pathologist's review of Day's body, and details in a Chicago Sun story led to false posts on social media stating that Day's body parts were missing. Someone goes on Instagram, which is owned by Facebook. Let's get coroner's report. Coroner reports Jelani Day's organs were missing when he was found, said one post published Instagram on October 11. The post's caption went on to say, the report stated the young man's organs and eyeballs were missing when he was found last month. The Sun-Times article cited comments from Day's mother, Carmen Bolden Day, and the family's lawyer, Hallie Besner, describing the state of the body. The family's private forensic pathologist could find no brain. The article quoted them as saying no organs, neither liver nor spleen. It went on to say Besner said the LaSalle County coroner had explained that according to their pathology report, the organs were completely liquefied. The underlying issue was deterioration that occurred while the body was in the water for several days, the county coroner said. We'll stop there. But there are, I guess, multiple reports. So I guess you can, some of this might come down to how much of this is deterioration. How long do we think the body was there? You can, like I said, there seems to be several of these reports that are more recent where they have the actual parents and they had several autopsies. I guess I'll share some of these reports so folks can read exactly what the parents are saying according to their second report about the organs being missing for Jelani Day. Not that this isn't widespread. We talked about that before in medical apartheid. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Get my PSA in again. Sobriety would be best if you're going to be out and about, I guess, especially if you have younger folks. Make sure you let them know this is a weekend you want to be sober. If you have to be out, be alert. Both for pedestrians who might, you know, be cutting a fool and have other things on their mind. I guess it could be young people too. Might be a good time to watch out. They could be out doing their thing as well. But older people, that was, you know, the danger that I was thinking in mind. Older people who are under the influence and out up to no good or whatever they're doing, not paying attention, and or older people who are driving, maybe under the influence and whatever they're doing. Lots of reasons to maybe not be out too much. If you are going to be out, alert, sober. Let's see. Folks spectating, I don't know if they have a mouthful of candy corn, all that. If we have any parents, I guess if you have any tips on ways to get through all of this, if you have children, if they're nagging, like they want a costume or they want to go trick-or-treating, or, you know, if they have white classmates who are talking about their plans and they want to go to their house and do that sort of thing. If we have any attempted parents who have any suggestions on how best to neutralize all of that other than not getting it started in the first place, always a good one. Feel free as well. Let's see.
Hey, I am an attempted parent, but honestly, if it's already started, I don't know what you can really do. I really don't know what you can do, because you don't want to give them, you know, the candy. You can give them the deal about the candy, how it's really good for you. Maybe try to talk to them about the history of Halloween. Maybe that might help. But it would be so hard if they're already doing it. That's my opinion, and I'm an attempted parent. So I just thought I'd just say that. Thank you.
It's addictive, candy corn, and, you know, the holidays in general, because they have so much propaganda that goes along with it. You know, if you don't participate, people get angry with you. I know I've experienced that. People, you know, that you work with or family and that sort of thing, and it just increases. Like, they start out slow with the, you know, July 4th and Halloween, and it just goes from there. Like, what? Thanksgiving, you gotta participate, you know. Christmas, you gotta participate. So yeah, if you cannot get it started, I'd say if it's if they're wanting like candy in the house, I could see where you could make that an activity. I don't have children, but you know, you could make that an activity where you can make healthier snacks, because they have like brownies, you could make cupcakes. That's like some of the traditional stuff that they would have. You could make cake. That's a traditional one. They have all kinds of recipes for, like, you can make homemade Reese cups, pumpkin Reese cups, no less. Because, you know, they have the some of the, like, smaller decorative pumpkins that are almost like hand size. They have some of those. Or you get larger ones that are slightly larger. And you bake them, cut the top off. Fill it with peanut butter, and you can get a healthier peanut butter, right? Bake it, take it out, coat it with melted chocolate, and you could, you know, make your own. That's easy, right? You can get your own. You can even get really fancy chocolate bars and melt them up. Cover it in melted chocolate. Either put it in the freezer, let it harden, and then you put it in the refrigerator or whatever, let it for, I forget the exact amount of time, but I mean, this is just one. Like, it's all kinds of things. You could make, like, pumpkin bars or whatever, like whatever you figure out, you know, some things that you like to eat or things that they like to eat, especially things for this time of year. It doesn't even have to be anything associated with Halloween per se. It could be, instead of Snicker bars, what I mentioned before, you can make apple pie. It's fall. You can make pumpkin pie, like whatever, but just make that, you know, as opposed to we go get candy that's going to rot your teeth out. And I think that can, just reminding them, really bad for your teeth. It's horrible for your teeth, the stuff that they eat. Just look at your friends and ask them, you know, what happens when they go to the dentist. They eat this stuff on a regular basis. Like, it's terrible and it's poor quality. Like, it's not even quality. Like, it's lots of things that are wrong with that. So I mean, if it's just we want sweets, lots, you can make it a total family project. I bet Z's mom has done that. She had talked before. I think they had like smoothies, and she had the chocolate brownies, what I just said. You can do all of that. So you can just make it a cool little activity. In fact, you all could go online together and find, you know, some cool Halloween recipes or just any kind of recipes, like strawberry shortcake. Well, it's not really strawberry season, but you get the idea. You know, find some recipes that you like, and then whammo, you have some healthier little treats. If they're really into that, And the rest of it, yeah, I would just try and really point that out, because I think so much of the incorrectness of white supremacy racism gets normalized in terms of these so-called holidays, like the macabre, like, just look at this. Just look, you know, let's go and watch, like, binge watch, not like watch one, but let's like spend the entire weekend from like Friday morning until Sunday. Let's watch movies about killing and not, you know, a just killing. We're not watching like Vengeance for Emmett Till, right? Vengeance for Jelani Day. Nah. Just killing for the sake of killing. Like, this is worse than a, you know, you called me a coon or you stepped on my shoes. This is just, you know, whatever. I just want to go kill up everybody in the town just because. And let's just watch that over and over and over. And let's go pay money to go see that. It's something that right there. And then people sit around and wonder, like, man, why did this happen with Kyle Rittenhouse? And why did this happen with Ahmaud Arbery? You got whole days to celebrate. Days, plural. You got whole days to celebrate killing. Now, you'll have a lot of folks who will say, well, this is, you know, Wiccan and blah, blah, blah. And they have Dia de los Muertos south of the border, which is all true. That's not what is celebrated here in the U.S. This is a lot of debauchery and drinking and violence and killing. I mean, that's what the whole thing is. People have lynchings. They had that for years. Go back through the Obama years, and they had people would use this as the occasion to put a lynching of President Obama out on the front lawn. I don't know what's festive about that. But I would just point that out, because I think children, you know, if you don't lie to them, if they use their brain computer, think about that. I mean, is this, what does this make you feel? You know, the things that you see on Halloween, or just let's get a list. Children are good at that too. Let's get a list and write down the things that you think of with Halloween, and let's go and see what they get. Blood, killing, alcohol, candy, you know, see if we get any, and then ask them, like, we'll rate the things that we associate with this day. We'll rate it constructive, not constructive. And let's see, you know, what this day is all about. Because they may have totally different words. It may have changed. Maybe those aren't words that we would associate it. Maybe they would say, you know, autumn, raking leaves. I have no idea. Pumpkin carving, which is wasting food. I would even point that out. They talk all the time. They have food insecurity. They'll put all these fancy words on it, and food deserts. They waste food, all kinds of resources all the time. It is insane. Like, wait a minute. We're not just going to grow food to waste. For you to put a pumpkin out on your front porch and carve and put some kind of goofy face on it. We have people who you say are food insecure. Like, no. Pumpkins can be, I mean, that right there is the illogic of white supremacy racism. Where you have people who don't know what to eat, have all these problems because we eat incorrect food. And then something like that, a pumpkin, you probably have tons of people who don't even see pumpkins and think of them as food. That right there is something you could eat. They just see it as, oh, that's something you carve up for, you know, Halloween. Sit out on the front porch. Insanity of white supremacy racism. Let's see. Folks have any other comments that they wanted to make sure they get in? No spectators. Give folks another few minutes if they have any commentary they want to share. The number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I will say, since I saw Emmy hanging out, we had talked about that. I just saw a report. I think it was St. Louis Public Radio. They're having this conflict over using the name of a hospital that was for black people, using this name to place it on a center that's now in St. Louis. And many of the black residents are opposed and saying, hey, wait a minute, you're appropriating the title to this facility that was closed down by racists, white people, that was made to serve black people. Black doctors, black medical professionals, deliberately working to help black people, sounding like Dr. Welsing. And to close the facility down and then try and take it like, you know, this is, you know, a rebirth or continuing that vision when it is not, excuse me. They were just like, that's not, you know, we totally oppose that. That is kind of standard in the system of racism, white supremacy. And it was even looking at that, because I think I had shared that report. Folks that know Emmy's been in med school and what have you. And just, I think she said that was one of the first things that stood out in her training. Like, wow, they have really done a lot of, invested a lot of time and energy to ensure that, just like with black teachers, we don't have black students in med school. Not an accident, not a coincidence. They are not trying to see another generation of Dr. Welsings coming to continue. Let's see if we can help heal black people and develop some counter-racist understanding of medical practice. No, no way at all. We're not going to be, you know, in fact, not just we're not investing in that. We staunchly oppose that. Super important, I think, to think about that. And that's something else to think about, I guess, if you have children, like not just how you explain holidays, their participation in them, like thinking at a very early age, like, what is your purpose for being here? Like, with what's happening on the planet, like how we even invest our time and energy, like starting up this holiday so that you can look forward to and participate in this for the next 20 years, or thinking already, like, I'm supposed to be using my time and energy to be a doctor, see if I can heal black people and solve this problem of racism, like me dressing up like some sort of hooligan or monster or ghoul. That's, you know, that's not helping me solve the problem. Like, trying to get that thinking in their brain computer metaphor as early as possible. Like, what is your purpose for being here? I think that's something all of us should be thinking about a lot. And maybe the earlier we start thinking about that question, the better. And I mean, you can tell them, hey, the answer to that question may change over the course of your life. That's great. That's a reason to keep coming back to that question. What is your purpose for being here if you are classified as black in a system of white supremacy racism? All of us should be thinking about and have really good answers to that question. Maybe you should even have an answer to that question before you have offspring. At least something to think about. I don't think that's one where you should have offspring and you have not considered that question in some detail. Anywho, let's see. See if folks have any other thoughts that they want to make sure they get in. If we have any attempted parents, any ways to neutralize getting through so-called Halloween. As I said, it's on a Sunday this time around, so maybe it'll be a little bit muted. But that could just mean that today is going to be super rowdy to compensate for having to, you know, quiet it down for tomorrow. Any other thoughts folks want to get in? Are they content to spectate? Folks satisfied? Sure. We'll assume folks are satisfied, hopefully safe.
Have you heard?
Our caller in California. Yes, sir.
Yeah, in regards of how to eliminate the Halloween stuff with the young children, I would suggest replacing the event with constructive activities. Like, for example, tomorrow, me and Z are doing a decoding of Charlie Brown's the Great Pumpkin. So you can just, if you have the understanding of racism and white supremacy, one should be able to decode like entertainment. So I am hosting a decoding of again Charlie Brown's the Great Pumpkin with a couple of attempted counter-racist children, and that's how, and instead of Z going out and trick-or-treating or getting candy, carving pumpkins. That's what we're doing. Tomorrow we're going to be decoding that movie. I mean, that episode, and I'm going to be telling her about what does a jack-o'-lantern actually mean, what does Halloween actually mean, and why is it being celebrated. But from what I've understood and what I've noticed, that when the child has an understanding or understands that they're in a system of white supremacy and most things are designed to attack them and retard them and just make them the worst kind of individual, they can very much easily stop doing what she used to do. Like she used to go trick-or-treating, all that stuff. But now that she understands that it's celebrating death and non-constructive, she uses that term too, non-constructive. So I hope this helps the caller or whoever asked the question. I mute my line.
Spectacular. Much obliged, caller in California. So I said you could just figure, you know, alternatives. And I have found that as well. He said, hey, Z, she understands constructive. That has been my experience. Non-white children, they do not have to be brainiacs or geniuses. They get it. Constructive, not constructive. Got it. Like I said, let's just make an assessment of what you associate with this holiday. We won't even, you know, use my jaundiced eye metaphor. Let's, you know, you sit down with a clean piece of paper, or we'll get a tablet or what have you, and just jot down what are the first 10 or 20 things that you can think of, or how much time do we have? We can maybe be exhaustive, and just as much as you can think of that you associate with this day, and then we'll rank them, like, are they constructive or non-constructive and why? And we'll just go through and see what we get stacked up. And I don't think it's going to be a whole lot of, you know, wow, this is great. If I do this that's associated with Halloween, if I eat this every day, I am going to be living my best life, the best version of myself I could possibly be, with the best smile ever. I don't think so. And you just go down the list with the day. And like you said, I think most non-white children, brain computer, they have been lied to, they have been poisoned with all the terrible food and everything else. Just give them logical information and let them process. I think most of them will see that immediately. Like, oh yeah, this is ridiculous. Like, now some of them, if they've been doing it for a while and they have friends that are still in it, family members, it could be, you know, some resistance. But I think a lot of them, especially the earlier that you get them, like, oh yeah, like, there are other things that we can be doing. Time and energy, I've seen that pretty consistently. Those holidays and the all the Christmas and all of that, they are super addictive if they have been going on at a young age and continued, and then they're still around people that are doing them. It can be really hard. But if you have an entire household that's, bam, we're not participating in this, we have alternatives, we're going to be decoding the movie and eating really healthy food and all the rest of it, like, oh yeah, like, that makes it easier to make that transition, and you won't feel like you're missing out on things. Anywho, assume folks are satisfied, didn't miss anybody else. Grant, we will be here. I was trying to see if we could get a date for Mr. Lax to discuss his book on his grandmother, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lax. Just trying to get a date and time. I told you I was taking my mental health days. I was not feeling A+ earlier in the week, but we were looking at days the early part of November. So hopefully I'll be able to speak with him. If we pick one of the days early in the week, it will be posted hopefully as soon as possible on Facebook and some of the other outlets. I'll tweet about it as well so that people can, you know, be prepared. If you have questions, if you've already read the book, that would be great. Or if you're at least familiar with the Henrietta Lax story, I feel is incorrect, history of abuse of Henrietta Lax. If you have some knowledge of that, then you can be prepped to ask questions. His publicist, I was speaking with for a while, trying to coordinate dates. I thought it was so important. She said that when Mr. Lax, black male, goes out to speak about his grandmother and how she was abused and, you know, whole medical terrorism, use of her cells and everything. And then the family not compensated. He said, well, she said, his publicist said that the sales of the white woman's book skyrocket. Not his book. The white woman's book, which we read on the book club. And I said, oh my gosh, this book is terrible. Like, I could see reading a book like this, you would come to a horrendous opinion of black people. Sales of that book skyrocket. Not Mr. Lax. That is what domination looks like. We will wrap up there. Much obliged to the folks who tuned in live and or archive. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy, particularly this weekend. Any weekend, really, under the system. But this weekend, there's already going to be so much debauchery and unsafe, reckless behavior. I would really be mindful. In fact, I would try to avoid going out late. Like for me, it's not, we're about to be 9 p.m. basically, Pacific time. Yeah, it would be quick. I wouldn't be trying to do too much later than 10 p.m. I would go ahead and let it go. You can, you know, get whatever else you got to do. Do that tomorrow morning early. Even tomorrow wouldn't be out too late. In addition to being sober, if you are out and about, be alert, especially now. Be alert. You might see anything, like two people in a zebra suit, anything, a dispute about a mask between two people in a zebra suit. I mean, anything. If it looks like someone is being hostile, time to go. This is not the moment to be in some sort of public verbal confrontation. You have no idea if the person is armed, even particularly with all the Halloween madness. Like, you got to be kidding me. Like, people are out and they got costumes and the gun might be part of the costume, and I'm good on all that. You should be thinking, this person, male, female, could be armed. And in fact, she, he could have an entire entourage of armed hooligans at the ready, ready to maim, get into some debauchery for the spirit of the holiday. Avoid all of that. Anything even looks untoward, exit. It has been a very reckless, unsafe year already. If you're going to be driving, you are super sober. You are not on the cell phone, and you are super alert. We need all of our attention for what could be happening around us. And we're trying to do just small things that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.